let's see, 4 guys here, and one is leaving, and 5 maybe, we'll see. And so we need help. Help! You people in Palatalk, help! We need your help, because there's only 3 of us here, and we're just going to get at each other's throats. So we'll start this thing in just about a minute. Let's see. And we go. Shabbat shalom, y'all. This is Mark. I'm filling in for Eddie again. And as you can tell, we're moving even slower than we would if he were here. What time is it? 4 o'clock. We're getting started at 4 o'clock. Sorry about that, folks, but about 2:30, I had to get some shut-eye, and about 3:45, my eyes opened, and I said, oh, where are we supposed to start midrash? So anyway, sorry about that. We've had a rather hectic last couple of weeks. Anyway, we're going to start with our Torah portion, which is going to be Exodus chapters 21 and 22. And so I'll go ahead and read the first couple of verses here. Now these are the judgments which thou shalt set before them. If thou buy an Hebrew servant, 6 years he shall serve, and in the 7th he shall go out free for nothing. If he came in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he were married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master have given him a wife, and she have borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. And if the servant shall plainly say, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out for free, then his master shall bring him unto the judges. He shall also bring him to the door, and unto the door posts, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. And if a man sell his daughter, or to be a man... Well, let's stop with verse 6, and see if there are any questions or comments. Do we have any questions or comments in the room here? Anything going on here?
I have a question. Do you think that slavery was something that Yahweh allowed for? Because do you think it was something that he wanted for his people and the surrounding peoples to exist with a regular ongoing slavery culture?
I don't think that it was something that he specifically planned, but I think it is something that he allowed. I mean, obviously, he's giving us regulations about what to do with servants or how to become bond servants, and so it's obviously something that he allowed to happen, and he made regulations for it to make sure that they were treated equitably. Just because you were a slave didn't mean that you didn't have rights in Israel.
What I find interesting is that even, of course, we're going to read that further as we get along, but it didn't seem like the rights of a slave were as equitable as a free man.
He didn't have... I'm sorry, what was that about?
Again, as far as the rights of a slave did not seem to be as equitable as those of a free man. If a slave were to be beaten and were to survive for 2 days or so and then die after that, the master would not be charged with capital punishment, even though it was a direct result of the beating by the master that the slave did die, but it was only after... I mean, you could have internal injuries. It might take two days for you to die.
Right. Right. The fact is still, it wasn't chattel slavery like it was if you had a stranger who was your slave. There are rights that the Hebrew slave had that the stranger slave didn't, or the Gentile slave didn't. But in this particular case, I mean, he could only sell himself into indentured servitude for 6 years. at the end of 6 years, he was supposed to go free, unless he decided that he wanted to stay. But the you're right; it is kind of, he is still the property of that owner, that slave owner, and therefore the rights of private property worked in there as well. It's it really is something that I don't have a cut and dried answer for. Yahweh allowed something that wasn't necessarily equitable, and then you know we're looking at this thing from 21st century American eyes, and not from 15th century before the Common Era. Hebraic eyes. I don't know. If anybody else has got something, I'd love to hear from them. Go, David.
You know, let's look at this now through 21st century eyes a little bit. When we take a mortgage out, you know, the scriptures tell us that the borrower is a servant to the lender. So... yeah, we become a sort of slave. I mean, there's so many things we can't do with that house. There's things we're bound and bond to do. It has to be insured because the lender doesn't want to lose his investment. Should, God forbid, there be a fire or something. When you take out a job, when you go for a job, you become a slave in a sense to a greater or lesser degree. Even some very good jobs, people who make six figures and work for a large corporation, if they invent something, it's not theirs. Anything that they produce or invent belongs to the company, even if it wasn't done on company time or with company materials. And I don't even want to get into the lesser jobs. I mean, they own you for 10 hours a day. They own your comings and your goings. And today you can't even necessarily be a Bible reader on your lunch hour. People have been fired for that. So slavery goes into many aspects today that we don't consider slavery. Even just living under this government is a form of slavery right now, the way things are going.
Very good.
When I think of slavery, I think of selfishness on the heart or part of one individual to be over another, because there's so many provisions that talk about taking care of the poor and the needy. And so if someone is poor and needy, why is it a better solution to sell yourself into slavery rather than to serve as a part-time servant for a period of time, which I guess 6 years would be something like that. But still, it just seems, though, that slavery doesn't have to be the way in which to resolve one person's economic depravity as opposed to another person's wealth. But apparently that's the way man's systems are at this time and always have been, that one man will try to rule over another because of various types of innate abilities or abilities that are acquired or because of chance and circumstance.
Right. Well, the taking up on David's point and answering your question right there at the beginning of your monologue, it's when you go to take a job, you have a choice at that particular time to either take the job or not. And it's the same thing I'm thinking with this. Right, we're supposed to take care of the poor and the needy. But if the poor person decides that it's it would be better for him if he were to sell himself into indentured servitude for 6 years, that's his choice. He's gone to somebody and said, I'd like to become your slave. I need this money in order to pay this debt or whatever, and I'll serve you for 6 years if you do that. I mean, it's
But the implications are so much greater when you're talking about 6 years as opposed to be a job where you can just, after a short period of time, decide, well, this job is just not going to be something that I can actually do well, or that I'm not going to find to my liking, or it is something that is definitely a detriment to my well-being. And then so you can choose to say, well, I'm not going to work here, at least in this country. But there, you know, there are situations even today. We have the slave trade in regards to sexual violations, and there's other kinds of slavery, white slavery, and other kinds of slavery that's going on even now, where people are being bought and sold and taken and used as indentured or servants of some kind taken from other countries, third world countries, and used in Western developed countries. So we see that when I look at slavery as an issue, it always brings up to me the selfish aspects of one individual. But again, as it's pointed out here, this person who has given themselves for 6 years, they can choose because the master is a generous and benevolent man, that they realize, I like being here. I like working for this person. I think I'm going to be here for the rest of my life, especially if the master's already matched him up with someone that he's agreed to have as his wife. And then basically you know that if you don't stick it out, you're going to basically give up the ability to be able to have your wife and children because they will remain with the master. So it's another reason why you'd want to stay on.
That's good. Other questions or comments? Go ahead, Tom.
Boy, we could look at this from 100 different perspectives. It's interesting.
Sure could.
I'm sitting here wondering if these people put themselves in a position to be slaves, or if they were slaves because somebody was trying to control their life. But also, I was thinking how we can't even compare apples to apples here. This is, like you mentioned earlier, it's such a different thing that was going on here than what we consider slaves. But as far as them being treated equitably, it seems like in verse 9, it says if he, being the master, designates her, being the slave girl that was purchased, for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. So it sounds like a totally equitable, familiar type situation there. I mean, they were not being degraded as we think of slavery today.
Well, yeah, in this particular case, he's purchased a bride for his son. And what does it say? And if he have betrothed her unto his son, he shall deal with her after the manner of daughters. If she please not her master, as verse 8, he hath betrothed her to himself, then shall he let her be redeemed. To sell her unto a strange nation he shall have no power, seeing he hath dealt deceitfully with her. And in this case, the guy bought her and he treated her wrong. And she didn't, okay, so she was able to be released. It was like he had bought her redemption price and now she's free. If he did it for his son and the son didn't want her, then this is no longer just a slave girl. This is now his daughter and he has to treat her as such. That's very different than what you would think from chattel slavery. Another one of those things that makes this a little bit different than chattel slavery. Now, we still have chattel slavery going on in this world today. It's not, this is not just a 3,600-year-old tradition or thing. I mean, it's been going on ever since and always was and always will be, more than likely, until the kingdom. And it's just, we're looking at something that we don't have firsthand knowledge of how the thing works. All we know is what's written here on the page. And okay, go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was also seeing here the shadow picture. In verse 6, we have, starting in 5, if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife and my children, I will not go out as a free man. And the thing with the piercing with the awl, in other words, he is becoming a bondservant of that master. And that's a shadow picture of our life with Yahweh.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's one of the reasons that this was given the way that it is, I think, so that we could see that, because we are bondservants. It says in the Brit Hadashah that we are bondservants and refers directly to this. Are there any other questions or comments? I'm sorry, I haven't been monitoring the room very well here. Work for yourself. Yeah, don't be in the situation where you have to answer to a master is the best thing for you. But even Torah is slavery to the Creator, Torah dude? Oh, we are slaves to righteousness. Okay, I'm stepping into a conversation that has been going on for a while, and trying to make heads or tails of it. And again, I'm doing the same thing that we're doing with the slavery thing here in 3,600 years ago. We're so separated from what was there. See, I just made a great illustration of what we've been talking about here. Step into your conversation from 3 minutes ago, and when I haven't been looking at it all this time. Okay, are there any other questions or comments on verses 1 through 6? Verses 1 through 6 of chapter 21.
Can you explain again the verse 7? If a man sells his daughter to be a female servant...
Well, we're just getting started there.
She shall not go out as a manservant do?
Yes, and if a man sell his daughter to be a maidservant, she shall not go out as the manservants do.
What
after
is it?
7 years. That's what it would... Or in the seventh year, rather. That's what it looks like. And I don't know why that is. You know, the whole 6 years as a servant, and then the seventh year you go free, is a picture of Sabbath, you know, and the millennium. And, yeah, I mean, the whole plan of Yahweh. So that is strange to me. If a man sell his daughter to be a maidservant, she shall not go out as the manservants do. If she please not her master, who hath betrothed her to himself, then shall he let her be redeemed. To sell her unto a strange nation, he shall not have no power, seeing he hath dealt deceitfully with her. Here's the master purchased this woman specifically to be his wife, and then he decides that he doesn't like her, so he's treated her deceitfully.
It means that he has betrothed her, and then
he betrothed her, and then he decided he didn't want to marry her.
Right. But that is verse 8, right?
That's verse 8.
But is it linked to verse 7? That's what I don't get.
I believe that it's probably illustrating what he meant in verse 7. I think that's where he's going with that. And if he had betrothed her unto his son, he shall deal with her after the manner of daughters. Okay. Then we get the verse in verse 10 where it's 10? Yeah, where it's talking about if a man takes a second wife. This is very interesting. You know, I make the joke all the time. You know, my wife just turned 52 this past week. And I make the joke, you know, I'm going to trade her in on 226s. Well, you know what? here's the deal. Take a second wife. There is no biblical restriction against a man having more than one wife. There isn't. However, if you've married a woman and you've been living with her for a while, and then you get another wife, the first wife loses no rights, she loses no honor, and she gets the same treatment that she's always had. You have to add treatment to the second wife, okay? Which theoretically impossible, okay? It is theoretically impossible. I cannot imagine trying to please a second wife and also please the first wife as I've been pleasing her for 28 years. It can't work. You know, so in other words, you get the second wife. All you have to do is not treat her the same way that you have one time, and she has right to divorce you. or at least to make sure that she gets to live the same way that she has all of her life, and you get to pay for it. You know, this is probably the idea of where alimony came from. Okay, ooh, yeah. Anyway, are there other questions or comments?
I have one. It seems like you had made a question mark regarding when a man sells his daughter to be a female servant, she does not go out as a male servant. As the male servants do, as if it was a seven-year thing, but it is because she's betrothed for a wife, right? Not she's not just a servant as a man servant.
That could be.
I would assume.
You assumed. You know. Oh, you don't want to go into that. That's a good possibility. You have something, Tom?
Well, I'm glad she commented on that. I'm thinking about that as far as we being the bride of Christ, it's a permanent thing.
Right. Yes, that is correct. Yes, the bride of Messiah is a permanent thing. All right, let us move on. If he take him another wife, her food, her raiment, and her duty of marriage shall he not diminish. Her duty of marriage. Okay? That means marital relations. If, you know, if she's been getting it three times a day, and you marry another wife, you got to keep it up with the first wife, and then add to the second. Let me tell you something. This is not something that's possible, especially after 28 years of marriage. Okay. And if you do not these three unto her, then shall she go out free without money. Okay. So let's. Which three are we talking about? She shall not go out as the men servants do. And what? Okay. So what we've done here is from verse 7 until verse 11, it gives you three conditions. Okay? Okay. If he take him another wife, her food, her raiment, and her duty of marriage, shall he not diminish. And if he do not these three unto her, then she shall go out free without money. I mean, that doesn't mean that she goes out free without having any support. It means that she goes out free. She doesn't have to pay for herself to get free. Okay? She doesn't need redemption. Exactly right. So, it's basically, this is a wife's right to divorce her husband. And then shall she go out free without money. You're absolutely correct. It says she shall. It doesn't say that she may. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? So all she has to do is bring the charge that my husband isn't treating me like he did before he got the second wife, and suddenly all they have to do is prove it, that he missed one of those three, and she goes free. But in the meanwhile, I think that he's also going to be required to take care of her. I don't know if that's the case, but let's keep reading. Maybe it'll tell us. Okay, verse 12. He that smiteth a man so that he die shall be surely put to death. And if a man lie not in wait, but God deliver him into his hand, then I will appoint thee a place whither he shall flee. Okay, cities of refuge. But if a man come presumptuously upon his neighbor to slay him with guile, thou shalt take him from mine altar that he may die. Do we have an example of that in history? No, but you know what? We have a possible reference to this in Yeshua saying, if you're going to the altar and you remember that a man has something against you, you're supposed to go to him and reconcile with him. Because here's this guy going up to the altar with his offering. If that's known to the guy to whom you have acted inequitably, can come and get you. Okay? Possibly. If a man come presumptuously against his neighbor and slay him with guile, thou shalt take him from mine altar that he may die. In this particular case, the guy has committed murder. He is... it is a premeditated murder. He's thought about it. He's figured out how he's going to do it, and he carries it out. We just had thou shalt not murder in the last chapter. So he gets to go be stoned, I think. It's not just a matter of removing him from the altar. You remove him from the living, the land of the living.
And like you pointed out, it says here, you shall not murder, not you shall not kill. So there's a difference. Because in some translation you see you shall not kill, but actually it's you shall not murder. Because sometimes we are required to kill.
Do we have no sound in the room? Oh, there we go. You know why you didn't have any sound in the room? You didn't have sound in the room because I didn't have my mic turned on. Okay. I'm Sicilian. I'm not real bright. Okay. Sorry about that, folks. Torah dude, I'm asking you a question again. Here, you ask the question, why do they not specify who may take another wife? I'm curious if you have any idea. Because usually we don't ask questions that we don't know the answer to. Of course I'm human. Okay, because I haven't got the slightest idea why they haven't specified. Somebody did say later on, well, maybe because there's no restriction on how many wives a man may have. At this particular point, there had not been any restrictions made. I don't know that there's ever been a restriction made on any society other than a Western Christian society. And specifically, I'm thinking about the United States, where we have other religions that were originated in multiple wives. You know, the Mormon religion was the first American religion. And it was founded on that. That was one of the foundational principles. So that's where the no bigamy law came, and it's we find it being enforced in the last few weeks in Texas. Go ahead, Susie.
Just thinking about, I don't know the reference, I think it's in Timothy, if you're going to be a deacon, that you should be the husband of only one wife.
Yes, that is true. Whether it's actually mentioned in at least two different verses of Scripture, a deacon or an elder should be the husband of one wife. And I don't know if that means he can only have one wife during his lifetime, or if it's just one wife at a time, or what. I'm thinking is one wife at a time, and I think, if his wife dies, he should be able to remarry, right? But the fact is that one wife, believe me, is enough. One husband, believe me, is enough. I mean, exactly. When we're getting ready for Oneg, we're doing a kiddush, you know, and raise the cup, and Eddie says the cup represents joy, it represents marriage, and I always stop him right there, and I look at my wife and I say, Debbie, how do joy and marriage go together? I don't understand, but, you know. She just smacks me upside the head and says, continue on, Eddie. You know. Okay. Have we exhausted that yet?
It's in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2.
1 Timothy 3 and 2.
Yeah.
Deacons be husbands of one wife.
Yeah.
And, I think it's mainly because we... having more than one wife would just be such a drain on your ability to do anything else. You couldn't possibly have a deacon be a husband, have more than one wife. He would have way too much involved trying to keep peace at home. And if he can't do that, how is he going to keep in peace in the church? You know, or in the kahal?
It's also repeated in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 6. If anyone is blameless, the husband of one wife, having believing children, not accused of loose living or being unruly.
There you go.
What?
And be meek, be merciful is exactly right. It is a type of our relationship with our one Elohim, the mystery of marriage. And you can find that in Ephesians chapter 5, where it talks about the husband. Loving his wife, a Messiah loving his church as the husband loves his wife. Or we are to love our wives as the Messiah loves his church. So, let's see. Let me read to you my personal commentary in my scripture here, in my marginal note. Hang on a minute. I need to get this up where I can see it. I have to take my glasses off and move my scripture closer. If he takes another wife, this cannot be done by any man. There is, uh, that is, that he takes care of his first wife, and in the same way that she's always been taken care of, and then he adds a second one and try to take care of her as well. It can't be done by any man. There's only so much sexual relations as a man can perform. And to split in between two wives would be doing too much. And to try to add to it, it won't work. It just won't work. So this is verse 11 is the grounds for the wife to divorce her husband. Failure to perform as he had before when the second wife comes along in any way. Okay? It doesn't necessarily mean just in the marriage bed, but anywhere. If he diminishes her accustomed use, I mean that's it. He's done. Yeah, the favorite wife child game is consistent in the scriptures. You're absolutely right. It is. There was always whenever a man has more than one wife, he always has a favorite. Okay, now it's easier, I think, to treat all of your children with more or less equity. But even so, there's a favorite. And, you know, you may not try to show it, but there is. You know what, for a man, the first son is usually the favored child. Okay? Because that's just, this is the reason that I exist, is to carry on, you know, my progeny. And this is the guy that's going to do it. The second son inherently knows this and strives harder to achieve not to achieve supremacy, but to achieve the same level of regard as the father has for the first. And it may not even be true. You know, the father may treat them both the same, but the second son sees the first as the one that's the favorite, and he strives to make himself better. And that's why you see second-born sons are generally the ones that are aircraft pilots, are second airline pilots are mostly second sons. It's just an incredible thing. I mean, I'm not talking about more than 50% of them, but I mean a larger portion of them than any other are second-born sons. Same thing with commanders in the military, the ones that really achieve high rank. You'll find that they're inordinately more second sons than any other. And it's because they're driven to achieve in order to get the father's favor. That's automatically given to the first son. I have just waxed psychological, and I promise not to do it anymore. Okay. Let us move on. Verse 12. He that smiteth a man so that he die, he shall be surely put to death. And if a man lie not in wait, but God deliver him into his hand, then I will appoint thee a place whither he shall flee. The basic commandment is, if a man sheds blood, then by man shall his blood be shed. If it was accidental, Yahweh is going to supply a place for you to go where you can be safe. And he supplied, how many were there? Six cities of refuge. On each, I think there were six on the west side of the Jordan and three on the north, on the east. I'm not sure about that. I don't remember. But there were a bunch of them anyway. Places where they could run, and none of them were more than 40 or 50 miles from any other place in the region. So a day, maybe 2 days trip, oh my goodness, I just hit this guy and killed him. It was an entire accident, but I know somebody's going to come and get me. So he runs for the city of refuge. He gets to get there. He has to stay there until the high priest dies. Let me tell you something. There were 12 high priests in all of Israel's history up until the destruction of the temple, so including Aaron. So 12 high priests over about a 600-year period. That means that guy runs to the city of refuge. He's there probably for 50 years before he ever gets out. He's not allowed to leave the city precinct. Otherwise, the manslayer can come and get him. Let me tell you. Yeah, but he doesn't have to be. He can not be put to death for an accidental slaying. but the manslayer gets him, he's free as well. That's a there's some real interesting laws in here.
I find it interesting that in describing it in this particular context, it says that God let him fall into his hand. Whereas in other places, it talks about how he's out in the woods and the head of the axe slips off the handle and it hits the man so that he dies. But in this particular context, it says that Elohim let him fall into his hand.
Well, that can be the same thing, Ron.
Well, I know it can be, but doesn't it seem rather strange in some respects that you know Yahweh knows about this axe handle and he knows about the head coming loose, and you just expect it to be circumstantial? But then here, it's not the way it's described. It doesn't seem circumstantial as much as it does understood by Yahweh. Of course, he understands all things, but still, it just seems kind of strange the way it's described.
Yeah, well, in this particular case, it's an accidental death. That axe head coming off of there was an accident, but Yahweh knew it was going to happen, and he probably has worked it out. He's the guy that's getting killed accidentally. There may be a reason that's happening. We don't know what it is. We don't know that it is. All we know is that the possibility exists that this is a way that Yahweh has taken that guy out of the mix. And there may be a perfectly good reason for it, but I agree. It sounds really strange. The manslayer can run off. Okay, six cities. Yes, that would accommodate a lot of clumsy folks in Amy. You're absolutely right. But if a man come presumptuously upon his neighbor to slay him with guile, thou shalt take him from mine altar that he may die. Okay, so when you find out that somebody's done that, he doesn't get to offer the sacrifices. He's taken away from the altar. He's not a, no. Mm-mm. A murderer shall surely be put to death, physically and spiritually. He doesn't have any spiritual life. He that smiteth his father or his mother surely shall be put to death. You know, there's a reason for that. The first five commandments are basically how we interact with God, okay, and how our relationship goes with Him. And that fifth commandment is, "You shall honor your father and your mother, that it may go well with you." Because how you regard your father and your mother will show how you will regard God. Okay, so in this particular case, he that curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. All he's got to do. He that smites his father or mother shall be put to death. He that curses his father or his mother shall be put to death. In verses 15 and 17. You realize that if you're doing that, then that's how you're going to treat God as well. And so, sorry, God says, you do that, you're out of here. It is a picture of idolatry. Okay? You've placed yourself above God when you place yourself above your parents. Anybody got a problem with that? Come on, make your case. Nobody's making one. Okay, Tom is.
Well, you can look at it from the other perspective. If you can't treat your parents well, then you can't treat Yahweh well. I guess that's kind of what you're saying.
Right. And Valkron is correct as well. The reverse is also true. How a parent treats a child will embed their feelings toward authority. And that's the truth. If you treat your children inequitably, you have absolutely a favorite, and there's no way around it. Nobody will ever make the case that you don't. You know, the other kids are going to have a major problem with you. I know people who have had children and have just completely used them for their own personal aggrandizement, okay? And I've always said, you know, as soon as those kids reach the age of majority, you know, 18, 19 years old, guarantee they're leaving home. Because you can tell by the way their parents treat them and the way that they react to their parents that those kids hate their parents, and they do, and they hate them for a good reason. And you can see it in the way that the parent treats them. And in and in some of the things that the parents will do to take advantage of the child, and maybe completely destroying him for life by doing so. So, yeah, it's you're absolutely right. Hey, listen, if you've got something to say, pick up the mic. Tom said, you're an exception to the rule since you came out of that mafia family. No, there's no mafia in my family. There's no such thing as the mafia. You know very well that there's no... Isn't that right, Susie? No such thing as the mafia, right? Okay. Susie is Sicilian by descent as well. All right, here we go. Verse 16. And he that stealeth a man and selleth him, or if he be found in his hand, he shall surely be put to death. He stealeth a man and selleth him, or if he be found in his hand, he shall be put to death. Once again, this is now we're talking about the relationship of man to man, and this is an illustration of the eighth commandment: thou shalt not steal. Right. So. That's my thought on it anyway. Verse 17, and he that curseth his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. In verse 18, now wait a minute, I have a note that I need to look at because it might be really important. I have lines and stuff drawn in my margins. Verses 12 through 17 are all capital crimes. Verses 18 through and 19 are crimes of retribution payable to the offended man. So, if men strive together and one smite another with a stone or with his fist and he die not but keepeth his bed, if he rise again and walk abroad upon his staff, then shall he that smote him be quit, only he shall pay for the loss of his time and shall cause him to be thoroughly healed. In other words, if you hurt somebody accidentally, or if you get into a fight with somebody and you maim him in any way and he's not able to make a living, it's biblically you have to take care of him. And that's where insurance steps in the way. You know? But now you see what happens is that the insurance companies will do that. They'll pay all this, and then they'll go after the guy that caused the injury to reimburse them. Let me tell you something. You'd be so much better off if you were to pay for the guy's costs than to let the insurance company pay for him, then have to reimburse the insurance company. Okay? Because the insurance company, you know, they'll pay $8 for an aspirin. They don't care. Because they're going to get it back from you. You want to talk about being an indentured servant. Boy, are you going to be an indentured servant to that insurance company. So, first thing, don't get into fights, because you might end up having to pay for this guy's livelihood for as long as he's laid up. Second thing is, if you do cause this guy that kind of problem and you don't take care of him, an insurance company will, or the government will, and they'll come back and get it from you. And it'll cost you 5, 8, 10 times as much. First of all, don't get in a fight. Second of all, if you do, and you hurt somebody, you take care of them personally. Oh man, I'm sorry. Let me take care of all your medical bills and all that. I'll do that. You'd be much better off. Go ahead, Susie.
Well, it reminds me of the scripture that talks about if you have a need to, let's say, where you think you need to go to court with your associate or friend or brother, then it says to settle out of court, because mm-hmm. that would be a lot less costly for, well, somebody, right? The person whoever loses.
Right, exactly.
So, same kind of thing.
I think the main thing there is that if you go to court, now they have, first of all, you're submitting to the authority of what might be an unjust judge. Secondly, if they find that you are liable for this man's livelihood, they'll take what you have to pay him. And if they decide that you're criminally liable, they'll also take your freedom away from you and put you behind bars. So, yeah, you're much better off working one-on-one in any kind of situation where you have trouble. Too often the law is twisted so the injured gets shafted. You're correct, Valkron. That's true. Okay, moving on. If a man smite his servant or his maid with a rod and he die under his hand, he shall be surely punished. It doesn't say he'll be put to death. He'll be punished. This is somewhat different in Hebrew. It says, if a man strike his slave or his slave, meaning that the slave can be a slave owner as well. Okay. In Israel, a servant could own servants. Look at the parable of the unjust servant. Okay? The Hebrew servant could own Gentile servants, for example. Okay? So, very interesting. Could you imagine a slave in today's world owning a slave? I don't think it could happen. Are there any questions or comments? Pal Talk or in this room? Okay. Notwithstanding, if he continue a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his money. Okay, that servant is the physical property, and he has equity in that servant. Okay, the servant dies, it's your own fault. You lost your property. It's a little cold, but that's pretty much it. If a man strive and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit depart from her, and yet no mischief follow, he shall be surely punished, according to the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. Okay, so if you hit a pregnant woman and she miscarries, but nothing else happens to her, then you get to make restitution to the husband for his loss, and to the legal system for whatever you've done, whatever the judges determine.
I believe that in the case of a miscarriage where the child dies, then he has to pay life for life, the life of the child. I believe it says if there's no damage, referring to that the child comes out but remains alive, is then able to continue to grow as a child would grow. But if the child dies, it's life for life.
Oh, that could be. That could be. If men strive and hurt a woman with child so that her fruit depart from her and yet no mischief follow. Yeah, good point. Good point. He shall be surely punished according to the woman's husband will lay upon him. And he shall pay as the judges determine. Okay, so that sounds like the husband can take him before the judges to determine whether or not he owes anything to the husband. And if the judges decide, well, yes, he does, then he gets to pay the guy what he demands. And if any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. And we're going to see this in the Brit Hadashah. It's referred to. And we need to understand what it is that it refers to when we get there. Because there was no such thing as, well, if you knock my tooth out, I get to knock your tooth out. That isn't how it works. Okay? In this case, it's someone else has been harmed that affects you. Right. It's the cost of it, more than likely. And if a man smite the eye of his servant or the eye of his maid, that it perish, he shall let him go free for his eye's sake. And if he smite out his manservant's tooth or his maidservant's tooth, he shall let him go free for his tooth's sake. Very interesting. This is, okay, the eye for the eye, tooth for the tooth, it's always taken out of its context. Verse 22 and 23 gives the reference for it. That's the context. If an ox gore a man or a woman and they die, then the ox shall that they die. Then the ox shall be surely stoned, and his flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be quit. I have to ask about nowadays. We have this thing running around called mad cow disease. If a man owns a cow and he allows it to be butchered and sold, knowing that it has mad cow, and that mad cow then infects 50, 100 people, however many will eat that cow, is he liable for that? I would say, according to the scriptures, yes, absolutely. What happened in Watchman 42? He comes in, asks if there's going to be a midrash, and then leaves. Doesn't seem right. Okay, if an ox gore, man, okay. But if the ox were wont to push with his horn in time past, and it has been testified to his owner, and he hath not kept him in, but that he hath killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and the owner shall also be put to death. It is, in effect, voluntary manslaughter. Okay? It's not necessarily premeditated murder, but it's voluntary manslaughter. He allowed that ox to run around knowing that it would try to gore something. Well, yeah, very much. It's like drinking and driving, having an accident and killing somebody. It's voluntary manslaughter, whether you like it or not. I'm sorry, you didn't mean to kill anybody. All you wanted to do was go out and get loaded and drive home. But on your way, boy, you killed somebody. Voluntary manslaughter. And you get to go to jail for a while, and you get to I think you should have to pay for every financial loss that the family loses for life. Okay. If there be laid on him a sum of money, then he shall give for the ransom of his life whatsoever is laid upon him. So he doesn't necessarily, he should be put to death, but if there be laid on him a sum of money, then he shall give for the ransom of his life whatsoever is laid upon him. He has the ability, if somebody says, well, you know what, I don't necessarily have to kill you, but I want you to take care of such and such, you'll pay this. You can get a buy on it. Whether he have gored a son or have gored a daughter, according to this judgment shall it be done unto him. If the ox shall push a manservant or maidservant, he shall give unto their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. There's where you get the 30 shekels of silver as the price of a servant, of a slave. And the 30 pieces of silver that were paid by the Sanhedrin to Judas for Yeshua. 30 pieces of silver, a restitution price for a slave. And you look at Matthew 26:15, and you'll see that reference that I just gave you. And if a man shall open a pit, or if a man shall dig a pit and not cover it, and an ox or an ass fall therein, the owner of the pit shall make it good and give money unto the owner of them, and the dead beast shall be his. And if one man's ox hurt another, that he die, then they shall sell the live ox and divide the money of it, and the dead ox also they shall divide. Or if it be known that the ox hath used to push in time past, and his owner hath not kept him in, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead shall be his own. These are all laws of equity, and they are all really basically common sense. These are things that anybody judging a situation would probably come up with exactly the same situation. Anybody else out there have a question or comment? You guys out in Pal Talk, we'd sure love to hear from you. We only have 3 people pitching in here today. Other questions or comments on chapter 21 of Exodus? Nothing in Pal Talk. All right, then, let's move on to chapter 22. There's nothing here either. Go ahead, Johnny.
You mentioned Matthew 26:15 about the 30s. So, what is it about? Is it about the ransom?
About the 30 shekels of silver. Yeah.
So what does it mean?
Well,
What that it is talking about the 30 pieces of silver, correct? That the yes, check it, make sure, because I don't have it open there. Okay, it is talking about the 30 pieces of silver that were
yes.
given for Yeshua.
That's correct.
Okay, that's the cost of what it cost to buy a servant in Israel. The servant's worth in monetary value was 30 pieces of silver. And so, yeah, now while you're marking that one in Matthew 26:15, right in the margin, that it goes to Exodus 21, so you can cross-reference that. That's what I do all the time.
Yeah.
Okay, how do you ransom a slave? Hatzahart? Do you have those have a heart traps? Hatzahart? Ransom. I don't know. Suppose you tell me. You got an idea? Yatzahart. I'm sorry. Yatzahart. No? Okay. How do you ransom a slave? Is that what this says? He shall give unto their master 30 pieces of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. An ox push a manservant or a maidservant. And he gets 30 pieces of silver for it. I'm guessing that is the redemption price or the restitution price for a slave. And that's all. I don't know how to answer that. Ransom is like a rescue, isn't it? Here's the deal. In the King James, anyway, it doesn't say ransom. It says restitute. It says he shall give his master 30 pieces of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. I didn't say ransom. I said restitution. Okay, you're making restitution, so the not necessarily a redemption. Okay, go ahead, Susie.
Well, it doesn't say whether the male or female servant dies. Side.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, it doesn't say that the servant dies. It says that the ox gored a manservant or a maidservant, basically. And this guy gets to pay 30 shekels of silver for that, allowing his animal to be free and to do that kind of thing. Okay, other questions or comments out there? NKJ says, redeem his life. Well, you know what? It doesn't say anything about his life having gone away at this particular point. Valcron had said, I realize the New King James says redeem his life, but okay, shall we move on? We're moving on. Chapter 22. If a man shall steal an ox or a sheep and kill it or sell it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. It's an interesting ratio. Why is that? A thief repays with usury what he's stolen. If he sells it or kills it, he repays times 4 or times 5. If he is caught with a live animal, he repays the stolen plus 2 more. So the crime of stealing, he has to pay something for having done it. If he's stolen it and sold it, then he gives that guy not only the money, but also the 5 sheep to go with it. If a thief be found breaking up and be smitten that he die, there shall no blood be shed for him. If somebody tries to break into your house and you stop him and he dies in the process, you are not guilty of any crime. And that is still the truth. Only at night, though. I don't know if it's only at night. Well, it says, if a thief be found breaking up and he be smitten and die. It doesn't say anything about night. Not here. If the sun be risen upon him, then there shall be blood shed for him. Well, wait a minute. If the sun be risen upon him, blood for him, he should make full restitution. If he have nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. I think that that's... I think that's talking about the thief having to make restitution for what he's stolen. I don't see anything where it says blood guiltiness. It says there shall be blood shed for him. It doesn't say anything about blood guiltiness. Anyway. If he's caught in the act.
Mine says in chapter 22 and verse 3, it says there will be blood guiltiness on his account. And then it says in the side margin, it says if he is killed. So that means that if he is killed, there will be blood guiltiness on his account.
Yeah, I don't...
It's almost like it's thrown in there, and then it continues on with the
yeah,
thought.
What I'm thinking is that you're getting a note from whoever it was that translated that, saying that that's the way that is, but it's not what's actually said in the text. If the sun be risen upon him, meaning the thief... there shall be blood shed for him. I'm guessing the thief. I don't know. If he's caught in the act, is the way that I see it, then he's got to make restitution. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. Okay, so the thief caught in the act will... I'm assuming that he's stealing the sheep or the ox, okay, and that he's killed it to it says in the verse right before it doesn't say in the right before, if he steal an ox or a sheep and kill it or sell it, he shall restore five oxen for an ox and four sheep for a sheep. So yeah, if he's taken the thing and killed it for his own use, and the owner of that thing sees that he's done that, then the thief gets to make blood restitution. He needs to give this guy back at least the four sheep and the ox, or five ox, or whatever it is. And he's got to make full restitution. And if he doesn't have anything, then he gets sold as a slave. Okay, and that is the restitution price to the owner of the sheep or the ox. If the theft be certainly found in his hand alive, whether it be ox or ass or sheep, he shall restore double. See, so if he's stolen the sheep or the ox and the animal is still alive, then he just gives that back and then repays a second. You will give double. Okay? Yeah, that's the way I'm reading that anyway. I could be wrong too, but I kind of doubt it. Okay, are there other questions or comments, folks? Out in Pal Talk, anywhere? Move on from verse 5. If a man shall cause a field or vineyard to be eaten, and shall put in his beast, and shall feed in another man's field, of the best of his own field, and of the best of his own vineyard, shall he make restitution. Okay, I believe we were talking in the... I think the Ronald's translation over there says that if his sheep or goats or whatever eat all the grass in his own field, isn't that something? What does it say there, Ronald? Please. I'm trying to remember what you read this morning.
Verse 5. This is the scriptures. When a man lets a field or a vineyard be grazed bare, bears in italics, and lets loose his livestock, and it feeds in another man's field, he repays for the best... from the best of his own field and the best of his own vineyard.
Right, so this guy has allowed his animals to chew his field down to the ground, and he's allowing his animals to go and graze in somebody else's field. Now he gets to make restitution with the best of his field when it comes back. Okay. time to... I think I hear my son coming in. If a fire break out and catch in thorns, so that the stacks of corn, or the standing corn, or the field be consumed therewith, he that kindleth the fire shall surely make restitution. And it doesn't say what the amount of restitution is, so I assume that it's one for one. If they've already reaped the harvest of the wheat or the barley or whatever, and somebody comes in and starts a fire and it burns up the guy's crop, then he gets to have his crop replaced. My neighbor needs to do restitution for letting their dog use my yard. You're absolutely right, Yatzahart. If a man shall deliver unto his neighbor money or stuff to keep, and it be stolen out of the man's house, if the thief be found, let him pay double. If the thief be not found, then the master of the house shall be brought unto the judges to see whether he have put his hand unto his neighbor's goods. For all manner of trespass, whether it be for ox, for ass, for sheep, for raiment, or for any manner of lost thing, which another challengeth to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges, and whom the judges shall condemn, he shall pay double unto his neighbor. Okay, so, if you... I'm sorry, Ronald, pick it up. Let's hear it.
What was that that someone in Paltalk had... It sent something in about their dog? It
said something about my next-door neighbor needs to make restitution to me because he lets his dog come over and use my yard.
Well, then, right. Yeah, but he may have to pay restitution to the other person for fertilizer.
He's getting free fertilizer. There you go. You hear that, guys? Okay. Yatzahart, did you hear that? Yeah. Yeah, you have to repay that guy because he's going to let his dog come over and fertilize your yard. There you go. Okay. Oh, you guys. Okay, then shall an oath of Yahweh be between them both, that he hath not put his hand unto his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it shall accept thereof, and he shall not make it good. And if it be stolen from him, he shall make restitution unto the owner thereof. If it be torn in pieces, then let him bring it for witness, and he shall not make good for that which is torn. Okay, so if I give something to somebody for them to keep safekeeping for me, and their home gets robbed. In other words, if I put something in the bank, and the bank gets robbed, the bank has to make restitution to me one for one. If I put money in the bank, and the bank takes my money, and uses it for its own ends and loses, then they get to repay me twice according to the scripture. Okay, keep that in mind, guys. Here's how we can get at those banks, because they're constantly ripping us off.
You mean when the money's not there on demand, they have to repay you double?
Ephraim's arrow. Yeah, I guess you can. Go ahead. Post the site. Okay, where are we? Verse 14. And if a man borrow aught of his neighbor, and it be hurt or die, the owner thereof being not with it, he shall surely make it good. But if the owner thereof be with it, he shall not make it good. If it be an hired thing, it came for his hire. Okay, so if I borrow something from my neighbor and I tell him, well, you know, let me rent your power washer, okay? Let me rent your power washer, and you come along with it, and you come to work the power washer, okay? I'm renting it and you to do the work, okay? So you come in, you work in the power washer, and all of a sudden the thing goes bad, and while you're in the middle of, hey, it's not on me. I didn't mess up your power washer, right? And beside that, I paid you what we agreed that I would pay you. And so you got from me what, okay, that's the way that works. Doesn't it? Doesn't that sound right to you, Katie? Got those big eyes looking at me. Yeah, you absolutely. FDIC rarely repays more than 10 cents on the dollar. FDIC rarely repays anywhere close to 10 cents on a dollar. You're lucky to get a penny on a dollar in actual equity, because the money you put in the bank is worth a lot more than the money you take out because of inflation, even if it's only 10 minutes. The inflation is so bad that you've lost. So, yeah, that's one of the ways they steal from you. Okay. And if a man entice a maid, that is not betrothed and lie with her, he shall surely endow her to be his wife. If her father utterly refuse to give her unto him, he shall pay money according to the dowry of virgins. Isn't that interesting? Boy, that doesn't happen anymore, does it? That doesn't happen anymore. I'll tell you what. A man entices a maid and lies with her. That's... I mean, you could call that rape. Okay? I mean, it may be consensual, but it's... Even so, he has defiled this virgin. If it's not okay with daddy, they don't get married. What if the guy doesn't even want it? You know, sorry, you know, this is a one night thing. You know, I'm not into it. Let me tell you something. That happens shotgun weddings. Can daddy come out with a shotgun? You defiled my daughter. You're going to marry. You can't do that anymore. Okay? The equity that is inherent in Scripture is taken away by our society. It's a very, very corrupt society. Okay, let us move on. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. Why is Hillary still out there? Ooh! How about Nancy Pelosi? How about Barbara Boxer? Oh, man. And you know what? We have some Californians in our congregation here, and they're going, oh yeah, Barbara Boxer. Why are these people still alive? You know? Why is Nancy Reagan still alive? Nancy Reagan. Not necessarily that she was a witch, but she certainly did consult with them. Astrologers. Nancy Reagan, not Nancy Pelosi, Nancy Reagan. I don't know about Nancy Pelosi. When I hear Hillary speak, it's, you know, this is, oh, wicked witch of the West. Oh, I can't stand to hear the woman talk. Well, anyway, that's, by the way, all of you guys out there that are listening that are government agents or whatever, opinions expressed from Beit Yaakov Hebraic Congregation are strictly those of the people who are saying them, and not necessarily those of Beit Yaakov Hebraic Congregation or Hebraic Heritage Ministries International. But they should be. Okay. Whosoever lieth with a beast shall surely be put to death. That'll be going away here pretty soon. You know, we've got same-sex marriage in at least two states. And the one state that has it is the one that is a barometer for the entire rest of the country. What happens in California usually becomes the normal thing in the country within 5 or 6 years. So you can expect that same-sex marriage will be normal throughout most of the United States under so-called Republican leadership. Yes, absolutely. Well, we've been under so-called Republican leadership for the last, let's see, for 12 of the last 20 years, and Democratic leadership for the other 8. So, anyway, he that sacrificeth unto any god save unto Yahweh only, he shall be utterly destroyed. Utterly destroyed. Now, I got a feeling that utterly destroyed doesn't mean that just that man's life is taken, but all of his progeny as well. Okay? Because it's utter destruction. This man will not have any offspring that will prosper. That's the way I see that.
Not only that, when you think about the time when Josiah went to the northern kingdom and cleansed the land, he dug up all the graves of the false prophets and those that were associated with the various pagan style worships and burned their bones till there was nothing left. He utterly just consumed everything that was a remnant of them.
That's right. Yeah, when Josiah went and cleaned out all of the gods of the northern tribes, he went up into Israel, and he wiped out all those altars. Yeah, you're exactly right. He completely drove out the other gods.
In fact, the situation of the prophet that came up out of Judah and was killed by the lion. If you remember the story, there was a prophet that was there that basically enticed the prophet of God to stay. And when they took the prophet from Judah and they buried him, he told his sons, "Now bury me in the grave of this man of God, because when this comes to pass, because surely this was a man of God, they won't destroy my grave," because he was already a false prophet. So you see, what happened is when Josiah came up and he actually did find out about the grave of the prophet from Judah that proclaimed over the altars of Jeroboam and all that would take place, Josiah said, "Yes, leave this man's grave alone. Don't even dig it up." And so the false prophet was right. He was probably the only false prophet that didn't have his bones dug up and destroyed, because he was buried with the man of God from Judah.
Wow. You're right. I remember having read that, and we'll probably get to that in Haftarah sometime pretty soon. Okay, where were we? 21. "Thou shalt neither vex a stranger nor oppress him, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt." Okay, what we just saw in verses 18 through 20 is... hold on a minute. I gotta get this where I can read it. That was capital offenses, moral capital offenses. These sins are related by their punishments. All are a result of verse 20, idolatry. It says, "Whoever lies with a beast shall surely be put to death. You shall not suffer a witch to live. He that sacrifices to any other god, save unto God only, Yahweh only, he shall be utterly destroyed." Okay, those are all related in the way that their punishment is to go. Verse 21, moral restitution payable to Elohim. "Thou shalt neither vex a stranger nor oppress him, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Ye shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If thou afflict him in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be your widows, and your children fatherless." You get that? You mistreat a widow or an orphan, and he calls out to God, God will visit on your widows and children exactly the same thing. Going to make them widows and orphans. Okay, because you didn't have regard for those who couldn't take care of themselves, your wife and children will not be able to take care of themselves. If thou lend money to any of my people that is poor by thee, thou shalt not be to him as an usurer, neither shalt thou lay upon him usury. Oh, I'm sorry, we've gone too far. Oh, verse 25 was the last verse, wasn't it? Yes. If thou lend any money to any of my people that is poor by thee, thou shalt not be to him as an usurer, neither shalt thou lay upon him usury. Usury does not mean what we think of as usury. First thing is, just regular everyday interest charged on a bank card is usury. Okay, because you're using a credit, if you use a credit card and it may have 15.9% and they sell that as being a low interest rate, okay, that's usury. Okay, because in 6 months you paid twice. In 6 years, you paid twice. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, Katie, you're way over there, and I can't see out of the corner of my eye.
I was just thinking about, where it says about putting to death the evildoers. So, really, if you want to reduce the population, do it the biblical way.
What?
Biblical way.
That's right. If you want to reduce the population, do it the biblical way. There you go. And you know what? You'll remove that bad influence from society, and society will get better. It's really very simple. Someone asks, will you please repeat the statement about Josiah again? Ronald?
Okay, concerning Josiah.
Here it comes, Deborah 22:3.
Okay, Josiah went into the region which was the northern kingdom. Now, it had been prophesied by a prophet from Judah who had gone up into the northern kingdom there at Shiloh when Jeroboam had set up the golden calf. And this prophet had spoken against the altar and said that a man named Josiah would be raised up, and he would come and he would utterly cleanse the land. Now, as he was preparing to leave, there was a false prophet that came to this prophet from Judah and told him that the Lord had spoken to him, that he was to come and spend some time with him and his family, have some eat and refreshment. But the prophet of God said, no, I surely cannot do this. But then he was convinced by this other prophet that he should. And so when he did it, he had disobeyed God. And so then when the man from Judah, the prophet of God, as he was heading back to Judah, he was killed by a lion. And then the false prophet heard about it, and so he went and got the prophet, and he buried him, and he told his sons, now when I'm dead, bury me right next to this man, a prophet of God, because surely what he said will come to pass, and I do not want my bones basically dug up and purged and burned to lime. And so what the prophet of God spoke came to pass, and what happened for this false prophet also came to pass as well, that he was preserved because he was buried next to this prophet of God.
Okay, very good. We got through verse 25. If you lend money to any of my people that is poor by thee, thou shalt not be unto him as an usurer, neither shalt thou lay upon him usury. It says if you loan money to people who are poor, to my people who are poor, that's very interesting, because the banking system in the United States of America, and I'm sure it's worldwide, is set up to make rich people middle class and to make middle class people poor. Okay? It's there. The credit system is set up specifically to make you poor. So, you're welcome, Deborah 22. She says thank you. So be very careful about how you use credit. You know, they send out these credit card things, and they say, you know, we'll give you 0% interest until such and such time. If you know for balance transfers and whatever, purchases, whatever. And those can be really good things. However, they can get real tempting because you got 0% interest on that thing until the end of that time. So you may keep charging on it, saying, well, it's like free money. You know, well, it's not free money because you still have to pay it back. So, you know, I saw last week on the YouTube an old skit from Saturday Night Live. The name of the book and the one page on the book says, if you don't have the money, don't buy it, right? And the husband and wife are sitting there and they're trying to make heads or tails of this. Wait a minute. Does that mean that if I really want it, then I should go out and put it on my credit card? And the guy says, no, if you don't have the money, don't buy it. Well, wait a minute. Does that mean that if I have a credit card and I still have some balance left, I can buy it, right? And he says, no, I'm saying that you save up money until you can buy the thing, and then you buy it. Well, wait a minute. Does that mean... It went on for 5-6 minutes, and it was it was just one of the most hilarious things I ever saw. And it's the reason it was funny is because it's so true. It is so true. You know, in order for something to be really funny, it has to have a basis in truth. And to be really funny. And so you see something like that, and it makes me crazy because people don't understand. It doesn't matter if the credit card has 0% interest. There's going to be an end of time when that thing has a 0% interest. And by the way, if your payment is one day late, the interest rate goes from 0 to 22%. And if you miss the next payment, it goes up to 32%. Plus penalties. That's right. Now that is usury. And that's what they're after you for. They're waiting for you to miss that first payment. They're waiting for you to miss that second payment so that they can steal your money from you. Okay, go ahead,
May I ask a question with regards
hello, Jessica.
To... Hello, with regards to usury as a definition, more specifically, is there a way in which interest can be applied and it's not usury? Or it does say that lends on interest to him. And
In the scripture, when it says usury, it's talking, and when it's talking about you're loaning money to a brother,
mm-hmm.
anything other than paying back the principal is paying usury.
So, okay.
Biblically, it's just interest of any kind is usury. We don't think of it that way. We think, oh, well, you know, it's only 10% interest. You know, I only have to pay 6% interest on the loan for my house. You know, that's a really low interest rate by comparison, but it's still usury, biblically.
So, but biblically, having loaned out someone who's a brother, who also is a brother Israelite, it's okay to do it if you're just asking for principal, the principal?
You can do whatever you want with what you own. If somebody comes to you and says, you know, I'd like to borrow such and such a thing, you can loan it to him. Okay? You're absolutely allowed to do that. And he has to repay you one for one. Now, we've already gone through a bunch of scriptures here today that tell us that if you loan it to somebody or you give it to him to hold for safekeeping and he loses it or he breaks it, then he gets to pay twice. Okay? That's just the... I mean, we've been looking through all these things of equity. Now it's coming down to if you're going to loan him money, okay, you will loan it to him one for one. You will get repaid one for one. You know very well that you're not going to see any income from this. So in other words, you're going to loan him money out of your wealth, not out of your need. Okay. No, you're not going to get any interest if you're loaning to a brother.
That makes sense to me what it says here that would be true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the end of our Torah portion. Has anybody got anything else from the Torah portion? Go ahead, Debbie.
It's slightly humorous, but it's almost like the question, who is my neighbor?
Yeah.
Who would you consider to be my brother?
A brother is a fellow believer in Messiah. Yeah, it says my people. Yes, exactly. Those who identify with the God of Israel. Good answer, Jessica. Okay. Shall we move on to the Haftarah, which is Isaiah chapter 56, verses 1 through 7. Oh, go ahead, Tom.
I love this section because I'm seeing it here as absolutes. We live in a society now that is leaning so much more towards relativism. And it's so interesting to see these statutes. Well, yeah, I guess there's still people that are on the fence, but it's so interesting. You know, you look at these things and they seem harsh, but on the other hand, it's good to have clear, defined definitions of how we're supposed to live. So it's an exciting portion from that in that respect.
Very good. Just looking through the Pal Talk chat here. Nelly324 says, wow, it was a mean world in God's days, in those days, and it's still a bad world today. things will never change. Yes, they will. Yes, they will. They won't change until Messiah comes, but they will change. Yeah, just read the end of the book. You'll find out that equity and judgment and justice will reign in this world. Okay, on to Isaiah. Anybody got anything else on the Torah portion? Isaiah chapter 56, verses 1 to 7. Oh, Susie's got something. Go ahead.
I was just appreciating what I could see as sort of an in-depth explanation of a lot of what was given on what we know as the Ten Commandments in these two chapters, 21 and 22. And I guess I hadn't seen that before, so it was helpful.
Okay, thank you. Anything else here? Okay, let us move on to the Haftarah. Isaiah chapter 56, verses 1 to 7, which go like this. I'll leave these glasses on so I can see. Thus saith Yahweh, keep ye judgment and do justice, for my salvation is near to come and my righteousness to be revealed. See, that's when we're going to see things get better. Blessed is the man that doeth this, and the son of the man that layeth hold on it, that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it, and keepeth his hand from doing any evil. Remember the last two chapters that we've read. Remember also the six years that the servant would sell himself into servitude, and at the end of the 6 years he goes free, picturing the Sabbath and the millennium. Okay. Neither let the son of the stranger that hath joined himself to Yahweh speak, saying, Yahweh hath utterly separated me from his people. Neither let the eunuch say, behold, I am a dry tree. For thus saith Yahweh unto the eunuchs that keep my Sabbaths, and choose the things which please me, and take hold on my covenant. Even unto them will I give in mine house and within mine walls a place and a name better than of sons and of daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. Also the sons of the stranger that join themselves to Yahweh to serve him and to love the name of Yahweh and be his servants, everyone that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it and taketh hold of my covenant, even them will I bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be accepted upon my altar, for mine house shall be called an house of prayer for all people. Oh boy, there's a whole lot of stuff in those seven verses. It's redemption. Yeah, we've already had exile. Now we're going to see redemption. Isn't it amazing how that works? Exile and redemption is in every book of this Bible. It's choosing, exactly right. It's Deuteronomy chapter 30, choosing life over death. You know, the Torah has, there is duality in Torah. The Torah does two things. It convicts us of sin. It convinces us of our righteousness. Okay? If we follow it, we will be free. If we do not follow it, we will be cursed. If we follow it, we'll have life. If we don't follow it, we'll have death. It's really very simple. Death, life, blessing and cursing. Equity and no equity, really. Okay. In Messiah, there are no dry trees. Talking about verse 3. In Messiah, there are no dry trees. Those in Messiah do the basics outlined here at the least. Okay, and what are those? They keep the Sabbaths and they take hold of his covenant. Those are the basics. Keeping the Sabbath pleases Yahweh. Those in Messiah keep the basics. Go ahead.
I know that's the obvious reason is because you're obeying him, but what is the deeper reason for following the Sabbath? You know what I'm saying? Preparation for the millennium, I guess, is what I'm getting at. Because of the 6 days that he created, and then the seventh day he rested.
Mm-hmm.
our benefit for following the Sabbath is to ensure that we receive that rest in the millennium? Well, there's a lot of benefits, but what's the deeper meaning behind the seventh day, I guess? We're practicing the feast for...
Yeah.
The Sabbath. There's
Sabbath
something very simple about following the Sabbath, and I'm just... maybe we pull out a couple.
Well, if I could say something, maybe if you, like you were saying back in Genesis, it was what Yahweh did as a pattern. So it's for our good. I think basically it comes down to He loves us because He loves us, so He gave it to us. And we walk in it to be obedient because we love Him. And that's, I mean, that... Are you thinking, but you're looking more for a futuristic answer?
Probably.
Okay. Well, if you think about when we, if we have the earth in creation 6,000 years, and the seventh is, well, then we have the millennial rest, then that's what it's a picture of, too.
I guess the question that I'm, or the answer I'm trying to draw out, but I can't quite put my finger on it, is what are we going to do in the millennium that relates to a Sabbath rest?
What are we going to do in the millennium that relates to a Sabbath rest?
Yeah.
First thing is, in the millennium, we won't have any physical labor to deal with anymore. We'll be in a resurrection body. Okay? We will be in the Sabbath rest at that particular time. We'll be helping to enforce the Torah. Okay? I mean, Yeshua rules with a rod of iron. You think that rod of iron is something that's going to reach around the world? Well, yes, it will, but it's going to reach around the world through His servants.
I guess I don't consider that a rest.
Well, why?
I don't know. Ruling and reigning to me is not rest. I don't know why.
Maybe we'll look at it differently. But
if we're in our fallen nature and we don't have our restored bodies, that may be something we don't understand in our minds as human beings that are fallen too. I mean, I can understand where you're coming from. That doesn't sound like rest, being in a position of ruling and reigning. But
never want to be president.
Okay, here's something from Teshuvah in the Shemini Atzeret, the eighth day. Recreation of the heavens and the earth that we see in the eighth day of the tabernacles. Okay, the final Simchat Torah, the Sabbath that never ends, reflected in the Sabbath every week. There will be flesh and blood people on earth who will still work, but it will be as before the flood. The rest will come in that we will be living for Messiah, mankind then, rather than our own things. The earth will be being restored to a pre-flood, I'm guessing, situation too. Wolf lie down with the lamb, etc. Is that where you're coming from, Teshuvah? Okay. Yeah, he's talking about in the millennium. I don't know that in the millennium we're going to have pre-flood conditions or pre-curse conditions anyway. The earth will be restored to a pre-flood condition. Yes, that's true. I believe that's true. Length of life will be, will be greatly enhanced. That kind of stuff. The world will be basically in a perfect state for us to live in, for people then to live in. We will be in a situation where we won't have to worry about. Well, yeah, there won't be any evil inclination in us. Yes. Okay. Yeah, there will be no evil inclination in us, and so therefore we will be resting the whole time. We don't have to worry about our labors anymore.
It's covered very well in Hebrews 4. What we're talking about
right
now.
Go ahead and lay it on us, Tom.
Well, You want to hear all this?
Oh, you weren't ready to actually talk.
Therefore, let us fear if, while a promise remains of entering his rest, any one of you may seem to have come short of it. For indeed we have had good news preached to us, just as they also. But the word they heard did not profit them, because it was not united by faith in those who heard. For we who have believed enter that rest, just as he has said, "As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest." Although his works were finished from the foundation of the world, for he has said something concerning the seventh day, and Yah rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again in this passage, "They shall not enter my rest." Therefore, since it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly had good news preached to them failed to enter because of disobedience, he again fixes a certain day, today, saying through David, after so long a time, just as he has said before, "Today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts." For if Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken of another day that after that. So there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of Elohim. For the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works, as Elohim did from his. Therefore let us be diligent to enter that rest, so that no one will fall through following the same example of disobedience. I think we covered it already, but it's no longer striving for that acceptance, that seventh day will be in his rest.
Right. We were talking earlier about how the second son strives to get his father's approval, kind of the same kind of thing. And there we go, waxing psychological again. I promised I wouldn't do that, so we're going to stop. That was Hebrews chapter 4. I believe he read pretty much the whole chapter. That's Valkron asked that question, so I gave him the answer. Rosie has something for us.
Yes, also about entering the Sabbath day of rest. Rest in itself means, like we've mentioned, to rest from your work, like whatever work is during the 6 days. And rest does not, I think, when you feed yourself with the word or with spiritual things, that's a form of rest, in the sense that you're filling yourself with the spiritual things. I think that's what the rule and reign means, to with a rod, to really remind ourselves or teach during the millennium, and to focus and to speak and to teach the Torah or the word of Yahweh, his laws. That's not work in a sense, because work in this world is tilling the soil or, you know, earning your dough. But when you work to do spiritual things, you're really filling yourself with the spirit, and it's not the worldly work. That's the rest, the way I understand rest. So like today, to be here and to be filled with the word and to, you know, study the word of Yahweh, it's not work. Although we expend energy, right? I mean, with my son running around, like, you know, you use energy, but you're filling yourself with spiritual food. So, you know, it's a rest. It's not, I don't equate it with work.
Right. I agree with you entirely. Where are you from? Nice accent. Rosie's Filipina. Nice accent. Okay. All right. Are there any other questions or comments on the Haftarah portion in Isaiah chapter 56, verses 1 through 7? Hit it, Tom.
A couple times in this portion, in the New American Standard, it's translated as foreigner. In verse 3, "Let not the foreigner who has joined himself to Yahweh say..." And then verse 6, "Also the foreigners who join themselves to Yahweh." This is one of the many portions that show that the invitation is open to all. It's to
the whosoever's.
Yeah, well, there's a couple words that I can't think of right now. The promises are to the native born and the something else, and to the stranger that is the sojourner. Yeah, thank you. And the stranger that is within thy gate. So even though you don't know what tribe you're from, you don't know your background, the invitation is there if you will join yourself to Yahweh and heed his commands.
Amen to that. Have we got other questions or comments on the Haftarah portion? Isaiah 56, 1 through 7. Learning and Yatzahart says to you, Rosie, I believe, learning and doing is worship because it is obedience. And worship is not work.
I have a question on verse 4.
Verse 4.
Who are the eunuchs of today? Because Yahweh said, if you obey my commandments and all that, I will bless your womb and, you know, you'll be fruitful. I'll bless your seed and all that. The eunuchs are those who don't marry and have children.
I believe that's probably true. I don't know. Eunuchs in this case, the eunuch was a person who was born a male who was no longer a male. You know, like you know the dog that was fixed. They've been so physically. That's what we're talking about. Spiritually, I think we're probably talking about the same thing. And that's basically what you're describing, is someone who is never married and has never had children.
But some people say that, well, I've heard in the charismatic or the people who do deliverance kind of thing, they say that if you are not married or you don't have children, like you're under the curse, or you know, that's why you need deliverance. So, but here it says...
I don't buy that in a little bit.
The eunuchs who guard by Sabbath and have chosen what pleases me. So actually they're right. Doing something that pleases Yahweh. So how can you be...
Yeah, they're doing what Yahweh demands of them, commands them to do. And that is Torah observance, and I can't see how that is displeasing to Yahweh in any way. There are those, Paul says there are eunuchs who are eunuchs for Yahweh's sake, and there are eunuchs who are eunuchs for, you know, whatever. The point is that, you have something? Okay. The point is that a eunuch is someone who does not have children, and for whatever reason. It can be because he's been physically castrated, or it could be that he's just decided that he's giving himself entirely unto Yahweh's service. Yeah, a celibate, exactly.
Mark, may I say something?
Go ahead.
I was just, in reading verse 7, it reminds me of what we were talking about last week in the millennial reign during the time of Ezekiel's temple, when we will offer up slaughterings, you know, and burn offerings.
Yes.
And yet it also reminds me of Isaiah 1. In all these things, Yahweh still desires a pure heart and them to be coming from a heart that is desiring to please him and love him, not out of something that just becomes monotony, you know?
Yes.
And so it just reminded me of last week and how it will come to pass.
Yep.
In the millennial reign.
You got that right.
Yeah, it'll be a good thing. It'll be a good thing. Part of the promise of Jeremiah, of the Torah being no longer taught from man to man, but being on our hearts, and Yeshua is the teacher.
Okay. Just to get a couple of comments here from the Pal Talk discussion. Valkron says procreation is the second commandment from Genesis, tending the garden to be the first. And Teshuva answers, well, some who are married and have no children, and Scripture addresses. But the Bible also says remaining single is as you are called to do that. Okay, so there are people who are called to be eunuchs, even though they haven't been made eunuchs physically. And so there's nothing wrong with that. If Yah gives you that call, then that's what you're supposed to do. If Yah doesn't give you that call, then yes, you're supposed to have children. You had something there, right?
Just speaking again on the Sabbath, I believe that the Sabbath is the first of some of the first of God's ways in dealing with mankind and of His order and of His kingdom. Initially, it comes to us right even in the beginnings of creation, where He rested on the seventh day, and then throughout the history of His people, He's established various aspects and views of what it means to come into rest with Him. As Tom was reading, talking about entering into a perpetual rest of walking in a manner of faith and obedience and communion with Elohim through Messiah Yeshua.
Went down the wrong pipe, did it? Okay. You're okay?
That's pretty much it.
Anything else on Isaiah chapter 56? Going once? Going twice? Sold, American. We're moving on to Psalm 55. Psalm 55 reads like this. Give ear to my prayer, O Elohim, and hide not thyself from my supplication. Isn't that interesting? Give ear to my prayer, hide not thyself from my supplication. In other words, turn your face towards me and listen and okay, give ear to my prayer. Attend unto me and hear me. I mourn in my complaint and make a noise because of the voice of the enemy, because of the oppression of the wicked. For they cast iniquity upon me, and in wrath they hate me. My heart is sore pained within me, and the terrors of death are fallen upon me. Fearfulness and trembling are come upon me, and horror hath overwhelmed me. And I said, Oh, that I had wings like a dove, that I would fly away and be at rest. Lo, then would I wander far off and remain in the wilderness. Selah. I would hasten my escape from the windy storm of tempest. Is that not true of all of us? Do we not do everything we can to escape tribulation when it comes upon us? It's human nature, isn't it? Is it possible that Yahweh puts us in the tribulation specifically to teach us something? And we keep trying to get away from what it is He's trying to teach us, maybe? Okay? Did Paul not say, I've learned to be content in everything that comes upon me? In tribulations and in gain, I've learned to be content. Should that not be the way that we all are? Okay, just throwing that out there. Because you know what? When tribulation comes on me, I try to find a way out. And it's, you know, and that's generally when we get in big trouble. You know, when we're trying to find our way out by our own strength instead of waiting on Yahweh. Because it's a good possibility that He's, you know, almost always. In fact, I can't think of any time when He doesn't wait until the very last second to deliver you. He waits. He waited until the very last moment. Israel's about to be wiped out. They finally called out to Him, and He delivered them from Egypt. Okay? I mean, it's just every time that a child of Yahweh is in trouble and remembers to call on Him first, He delivers. You know? He made... Wait until the very last second. You know, it's 11:59 and 59 seconds, and you've got to have that thing paid by midnight, and bang, there it is. He delivers you from the trial, whatever it happens to be. He'll do it. The more we try to work our way out of it, the more we work ourselves into a bigger mess. It's kind of like when the government sees a problem and decides to try to fix it, and they always mess it up. Always. Okay, they make it worse. They make it 50 times worse. That's not to say that they're trying to make it worse. They're trying to make it better. I think they're working in the integrity of their hearts, trying to do things right. But they go about it all wrong because they're trying to escape this trouble. Why not just let it go and repent? Turn to Yahweh and tell Him, deliver me. Now, it could very well be that this country could be delivered from the judgment that's coming if the leaders of the government were to say, I repent in dust and ashes. Deliver me. I think he'd do it. I think he'd do it in a minute. Anybody got a question or comment up to there?
Just a couple little notes that I wrote down. That for one thing, Yahweh is our defender, and he uses the wilderness for us as an escape from the enemy and as a place of testing to see if we will rely on him.
Okay. In what I was just saying, Velkron says, but if we sit on our hands when we can act, then we will be held accountable. No? Not necessarily. I mean, we can always act. Are we acting in the way that Yah wants us to act? That's the point. You see, when I say that when I get into tribulation, I immediately try to find a way out. I didn't say that I prayed to Yahweh and said, Yahweh, show me a way out. I said, I try to find a way out. Okay? And when I try to find a way out, I screw it up worse. Same thing with the government. When they try to find a way out of a problem, they make it worse. It's not like we don't get the government we deserve, because we all do the same thing. You have something, Deb?
A lot of things. And they're all interrelated, and they kind of cancel each other out. One thing being that I've been through some extreme tribulation, I would say trying to work it out in your own strength, yes, that's the first temptation or one of the first temptations. After you know that's not going to work and you cry out to the Lord with everything in you, he may still wait to the last minute when you know it's over and it's truly over. Somehow after it's over, I'm still here.
Yeah.
I shouldn't be.
All right. Yeah. Anakin 041 says, a tough act, waiting.
And isn't that... You weren't there. I told Danny yesterday, we worked our tushies off yesterday,
yeah,
being patient.
That's right. We did. Well, it's a long story.
We were prepared to work physical carpentry-like labor. We had a truck full of wood to create crates. We were not permitted to make one crate. However, it took us all day long to get to where we could get to our deliverance.
That's right. That's right. And Yah made a way. And I don't know that Yah made a way or if we saw the tribulation and acted to fix it without even consulting him.
Oh, no. We all prayed.
I really and truly do think that we were acting on Yahweh's direction. Like she said, you know, we were at this place at 9 o'clock in the morning to do whatever we needed to do to get stuff ready to ship. And we were not allowed to touch anything with our own hands. And so, yeah, we went into prayer and Yahweh opened a couple of doors, possible doors. We went and investigated one of them, and the man was, this is a vice president of a company who's out in the shop working with his guys. And he told us what he could do, how much it would cost. It was not exorbitant. And so we said, great, let's do it that way. I think Yahweh led us to this particular guy. And it works out very well. And we got it done at the last minute. Okay? I mean, the very last minute. We left that guy's shop 2 minutes before his closing time. We took the vehicle that we needed to rent in order to get it all done back to where we got it. And I walked into the place 1 minute before closing time. Okay, I mean, we were back down to the last minute.
And you unloaded the truck.
We did it. And
2 minutes before,
that's right,
Shabbat Shalom.
We had to deliver a bunch of stuff in the truck that we were carrying, and we got it delivered and unloaded, and our work was done 2 minutes before Shabbat. It absolutely amazing. All day, Yahweh was bringing us to the point at the very last moment that we could possibly get it done.
And what happened at the first moment, Mark? We ran into the enemy.
Oh, boy.
The powers that be were there to meet us.
Oh, yeah, as a matter of fact, the first place we went into was being invaded at that particular moment by the Department of Homeland Security, the Transportation Safety Administration. So, I mean, they were doing a terrorist check on the place to make sure there were no terrorists in the place. But you know what? And now this is my opinion, and only my opinion, and not necessarily that of Beit Yaakov or of Hebraic Heritage Ministries International. But as far as I'm concerned, the Transportation Safety Administration and the Homeland Security Department is the greatest terrorist organization in the world. Okay, anyway, and Marley says, amen. Thank you. Let us move on. We only read a little bit of Psalm 55 here. Where did we end? Verse 8. Okay, so verse 9. Destroy, O Yahweh, and divide their tongues, for I have seen violence and strife in the city. Day and night they go about it upon the walls thereof. Mischief also and sorrow are in the midst of it. Wickedness is in the midst thereof. Deceit and guile depart not from her streets. For it is not an enemy that reproacheth me. Then I could have borne it. Neither was it he that hated me that did magnify himself against me. But I would have hid myself, or I would have hid myself from him. But it was thou, a man mine equal, my guide and mine acquaintance. We took sweet counsel together and walked into the house of Elohim in company. Now this applies very specifically to Judas Iscariot and Yeshua. This is Yeshua speaking and talking about Judas Iscariot. He says, this is a man mine equal. It was not an enemy that reproached me. Then I could have borne it. Neither was it he that hated me that did magnify himself against me. Then I would have hid myself from him. But it was thou, a man mine equal, my guide, mine acquaintance. Okay? So the one that delivered Yeshua, remember we read earlier about 30 pieces of silver being the restitution price for a slave. it's amazing how this stuff works together, doesn't it? The fact is that this isn't just Judas Iscariot. This happens to all of us. All of us end up having someone who has always been, on the surface, a friend, who has turned against us for one reason or another. I know it's happened to me. I know it's happened to Deb. It's probably happened to other people as well. I really think that that's a common thing among mankind.
And when it happens, that's when the cry goes out the loudest to Yahweh. And I wonder if he allows it to happen. Although I don't believe... Yeah. Do you... What would
that's
you...
That's a possibility. That he allows that to happen specifically so that we'll turn to him and ask
to
for
to cry out. But do you think Yahshua cried out to the Father in the garden over what Judas did or was going to do?
Actually, Judas had already left. He knew that it was going on. Judas was coming at the very moment that he was crying out to Yahweh in the garden. Judas was coming from the city with 100 temple guards.
So he was sweating great drops of blood over what Judas was doing?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Any other questions or comments up to where were we? Verse 14?
Oh, I have a comment. Judas went and killed himself after that, Mark. Now,
yes, that's true.
What was it you were just saying that would happen to someone that it was the previous scriptures you were saying? I missed it. I don't think it was Isaiah. I think it was the Torah reading.
Uh-huh.
There was something that happens if you do this to a widow or the children or something else.
Yeah.
Then there's
right.
Something that happens to you if you do it.
Well, yeah, you pretty much get the same judgment that you were going to meet out on. Okay, if you don't take care of a widow or an orphan, then Yahweh will see to it that your wife and children are widows and orphans.
Okay, but that's not okay. So that's not what happened to Judas. Judas didn't commit suicide because of that repercussion coming upon him for what he did.
No, that's probably
that's
true.
My question.
He did that because of, I'm certain, because Judas wasn't betraying Yeshua. He wasn't expecting him to be betrayed unto death. He was expecting him to go and be interviewed. Okay? He said, I think that he was trying to reconcile Yeshua with the Sanhedrin and didn't understand that the Sanhedrin just wanted to kill him. And so they were looking for somebody who would deliver him. And I think that Judas was trying to reconcile the two sides in his own strength.
Now, was Judas Iscariot married with children?
That I couldn't tell you.
Because
I assume
then
he was.
Because
I assume that he was.
Because then it would be true. They would be made widows.
Yes.
She would have been made a widow, and they would have been without. Yeah. So, yeah.
Go ahead, Rosie. I'm sorry.
Or was he looking for money and then thinking that Yeshua would escape?
I don't know. That could be, but I don't know.
Wasn't Judas upset that Yeshua didn't come to have the kingdom restored to Israel?
Well, yes. I believe that Judas was a zealot, and he was working for the kingdom of Israel to come right that moment.
To be
and
restored.
That was what he was expecting from Yeshua. Yeah, he was trying to force Yahweh's hand is what I think was going on. But he was. I also believe that he was doing it in the integrity of his heart. I could be wrong about that, but that's what I think. I don't think that he was doing this in a malicious way. I don't think he was trying to be malicious with Yeshua. I think he was trying to force him into that position, though.
But wasn't he present when the Lord spoke to him? They were having the Last Supper.
Yeah.
They were all around the table, and the Lord said that one will betray me tonight. And the disciple says, "Who
is
that going to be?"
That is true.
He says, "The one I'm dipping this out with now." And he pointed to Judas and he said, "Go and do what you intend to do."
That's true. That's true. He did. But the only one that got that whole the only one that understood what was going on there was John, who asked the question, "Who is it?" You notice that all the rest of the disciples were saying, "Is it me? Is it me? Is it me?" John said, "Who is it?"
But did not
John knew very well it wasn't him.
But did not Yahshua say to Judas when he kissed him, "Judas, betrayest thou me with a kiss?"
Yeah, and I think that's when he came to his senses. That was when he went, "Oh my goodness, did I betray him?" All he really wanted in his mind, anyway, was to bring Messiah, who he knew would be Messiah. He knew was the king. And he wanted to bring him to the Sanhedrin and bring them together.
But did not Yeshua give him the opportunity to repent or not do what he intended to do by what he said when they came? He said, "I am he." And they all fell back?
Oh, he didn't say, "I am he."
Well,
he
just said,
"I am."
And they all fell back?
Yeah.
And then Peter cut off the one. None of that you think was involved.
We're getting way off on this. I'm not certain where I can go with that. Those hundred guys all fell on their butts. It did say that he stole money from the bag already. Now you know what? Teshuvah. It says that he stole money from the bag. That doesn't necessarily mean that anybody knew that he had stolen money from the bag at that time. I believe that's an editorial comment that John makes to say, well, you know, this guy stole money from it. He carried the bag and he stole money from it. I don't necessarily think that they knew that before Judas no longer had the bag. Okay? He was still carrying the money bag. Maybe he was getting those 30 pieces of silver to put in the money bag. I don't know. We assign motive where no motive is actually shown. Okay?
Yeah, but we know that it has to do with money. It's around money and interact with money, probably.
Yes,
something like
absolutely.
That. I would say something like that. No, follow the money. No.
And Teshuvah, you're absolutely right. Feeling guilty and true repentance are two different things. You're absolutely correct. I have an acquaintance who is in jail. He's making noise about, I want to change my life. He actually did what he's in jail for. Okay? And he admits very freely that he did what he's in jail for. And he says, I want to change my life. I want to change my life. I do not want to be like this. Okay? But you have to wonder, does he really, truly have a repentant heart? Or is he only sorry because he got caught? Okay? Very often, they're only sorry because they got caught. Okay? But it's hard to know that. Without being in the guy's mind, it's hard to know that. So, as far as I'm concerned, we need to take them at least at what they say until they prove that you know, something different. Okay? Yeah, we judge their fruits. Exactly right. Now, this guy's going to be out of jail in a year or two, and we'll find out when he gets out whether or not he's really repentant. Okay? We've told him already, my wife and I have told him already, if you want to change the way you work, the way you live, you need to change your associates. Because the people you're hanging out with are building this stuff in you. Okay? So, you need to completely change your associations. And that's a hard thing to do. Anyway, go ahead, Ren.
Yeah, Psalm 55, at least my understanding, is a psalm that David composed during the time that he was being attacked by Absalom, his son. Yes, and what I believe is the understanding for this particular scenario that has developed with his desire to see vengeance upon someone who was considered one time his friend, his companion, his counselor. Well, it's kind of interesting the situation that developed there in the kingdom. There was Bathsheba, who was the wife of Uriah, who was one of the mighty men of David. And apparently she lived close by his palace, and when Uriah was off at war, she was busying herself at home, and at one point in time she was visibly exposing herself to some degree to David's presence, to the degree that he lusted after her, and he arranged for her to come to his home, and things precipitated, and she became pregnant with his son. And then he tried to get Uriah to come back and to have relations with Bathsheba to try to alleviate what he thought would be a solution to the problem. Eventually, he sent word to Joab by the hand of Uriah that Uriah should be placed where the battle would be fiercest, where the archers would be, where he would be more than likely struck down. And such was the case. And so Joab conspired with David in regards to the destruction or the death and murder of Uriah. Now, Bathsheba happened to be the daughter of Eliam, who was also one of the mighty men of David. And I imagine that he probably thought it was rather strange, being that he knew that Joab was a very good commander. And he thought, you know, isn't this rather strange? Now, my daughter has married my good friend Uriah, who happened to be one of the mighty men with me. And Job places Uriah right in this place where the battle of six, and then has the men pull back, and Uriah is left there unguarded, and he's struck down. It just doesn't make sense to me. He gets back home, and he talks to his dad and says, Dad, it's rather strange. This is what happened to Uriah. You know, he's been struck down. Now, Ahithophel is the grandfather to Bathsheba, the father of Eliam, who was one of the mighty men, who was probably an associate and friend of, probably must have been a very close friend of Uriah, because he was also his father-in-law, because it was his daughter, Eliam's daughter Bathsheba, that married Uriah. Well, Ahithophel was considered to be the most intelligent man of the time and of the day. His counsel was considered to be, well, likened unto well, Solomon hadn't been born yet at that point in time. Of course, he was the son of Bathsheba, but he was of that and that intelligence. And so you can even see part of the reason why maybe Solomon was so intelligent, because he came from a lineage of great intelligence. Ahithophel probably saw all the goings on. He was not he was a very intelligent, wise, and discerning man. And he saw what was developing. He saw the situation. And the problem that he probably had is that he didn't go about resolving it in his own heart the right way. Instead, he allowed bitterness to grow in his heart. And when he had an opportunity, he conspired with David's son, Absalom, to give counsel to Absalom how he would defeat David. Now, why would this man who was his trusted, David's trusted counselor and friend, turn against him on behalf of David's son, Absalom? I can only think of it because he was angry in his own heart that justice hadn't been done. And he was seeking to take vengeance upon David in a way that he thought he could. And so here is the situation. Now, David's probably wondering in his own heart, but he probably has understanding of the situation as well. And the only thing that David can do at this point is to turn to Yahweh. And I think that that's would have been the better solution for Ahithophel as well. But because of what happened in his own heart, he must have abandoned some of his own personal faith at that point in time because of the circumstances developed with the loss of his grandson-in-law and what he saw was considered to be an injustice. So that's my take on this particular psalm.
That's really good. We have a comment in here. But David did repent, and you raised that. You said, yeah, he turned to Yahweh. When Nathan came to him and said, you're the man, you know, he went, whoa. I haven't told anybody about this, and Bathsheba hasn't told anybody about this. And you know, boy, I'll tell you what, he's... Yeah, Yahweh, let him know. There's somebody out here that knows what's going on, whether you know they know it or not. It could be that the whole nation knew it, and it could be that only Yahweh knew it. But it's possible that Ahithophel knew. It's certain that Joab knew. Okay, but other than that, I mean, there are maybe 5 or 6 people that we can think of that knew what was going on, other than David, very close to the situation. Nathan was not told, I'm certain, by any human being. Okay, so David knew very well when Nathan the prophet came to him and said, you're the man that did this. Yahweh knows. That's when he went, oh my goodness. You know, it's true. Yahweh does see us in everything that we do and at every moment. He knows our sin before we even do it. We need to be very careful. We need to walk a very circumspect road. Okay. Other questions or comments here? We'll move on in Psalm 55, starting at verse 15. Let death seize upon them, and let them go down quick into hell, for wickedness is in their dwellings and among them. If hell is the grave, by the way, many people say that that's the grave, and in many translations it says the grave. If hell is the grave, then why not say into the grave? Death does not necessarily mean the death of the body. In this particular case, let death seize upon them. I don't believe it's talking about the death of the body. I think it's talking about spiritual death. And that's what I think that David is praying for these particular people. Or for this particular person, actually. It would be Absalom. This is a very strong imprecatory prayer. Imprecatory meaning he's calling down judgment on them. I doubt seriously that Yeshua would say something this way about... But you know what? It's Yahweh. And Yahweh says, if you don't obey me, you're worthy of death. And so even in the case of Judas Iscariot, the man that walked with him for 3 years, he would have been saying exactly the same thing.
No, he was when he was hanging on the cross, Yeshua said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And what we've described earlier, which we're talking about in regards to Judas and his plot, he didn't understand completely, from at least the perspective that you were giving.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that Yeshua would have forgiven him and given him redemption if he would have repented accordingly.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. You're right. Which means that I was... No, I can't. Okay. Okay. As for me, I will call upon Elohim and Yahweh shall save me. I will call upon Elohim and Yahweh shall save me. Isn't that interesting? Evening and morning and at noon will I pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice. He hath delivered my soul in peace from the battle that was against me, for there were many with me. Elohim shall hear and afflict them, even he that abideth of old, Selah. Elohim shall hear and afflict them, even he that abideth of old, Selah. Stop and think about that. Because they had no changes, therefore they fear not God. Isn't that something? It says, Yahweh will hear and afflict them, that is his enemies, even he that abideth of old. Now, is that Yahweh that abideth of old? Or is that the enemy that abides of old? Let's look at those other translations that we've got in the room and see if there's any clarification on that. Because the King James can be read either way.
Yeah, here in my translation it says he with capital H. So probably...
Okay, he with a capital H, that's in the Restoration Scriptures.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. New American Standard has even the one who sits enthroned from of old.
Okay.
So that would be Yahweh.
That would definitely be Yahweh. Okay, so that clarifies that for me. God will hear and afflict them, even he that abideth of old, Selah. Because they have no changes, therefore they fear not God. That means that they're set in their ways, and they will not change. It's not that they can't change, it's that they won't change. They're set in their denominational and dispensational mindsets and traditions. They will not change when shown the truth. That's the way I'm looking at it anyway in the last few years. I'm seeing this as people who call on the name of Yahweh, or they identify themselves with Yahweh, and yet they don't change their opinion when they're shown truth. Okay? That's who I take that to be. And that's a rough thing to say, but that's how that is in my own mind. He hath put forth his hands against such as be at peace with him. He hath broken his covenant. The words of his mouth were smoother than butter, but war was in his heart. His words were softer than oil, yet were they drawn swords. Do you remember the OJs back in the 1970s? They made a song called Backstabbers. They smile in your face all the time. They want to take your place, the backstabbers. Okay? Says perfectly what Absalom wanted to do with David. Okay? He smiled in his face all the time. He was trying to work it so he could take his place. A backstabber. Okay. Great song, by the way. I like the OJs. I really did. He hath put forth his hands against such as be at peace with him. Okay. Cast thy burden upon Yahweh, and he shall sustain thee. He shall never suffer the righteous to be moved. But thou, O Elohim, shalt bring them down into the pit and destruction. Bloody and deceitful men shall not live out half their days, but I will trust in thee. So what's the basic gist of this psalm? Tom? Ah, exile and redemption. That's right. Just wanted to get that in because Eddie wasn't here. I wanted to make sure that somebody, that everybody understands that the, every psalm here is about exile and redemption. Does Yehovah know what we will choose? Yes, I believe he does. I believe that here's the way I think. Yahweh gives us free will. He knows the way that things will go, what we will freely choose. He gives us the choice of whether to do his will or to not do his will. If we do his will, then it's very cut and dried what's going to happen. If we don't do his will, then it depends on what we're going to do. I don't know that he at the beginning of time knew which choice each of us would make in each individual time. I think that he saw all of the possibilities and created the timeline to fit it. Okay? So that if I decided to take this branch, that's the timeline I would go down, and then I'd have another branch to go through, and he had that all planned from the beginning, and he saw every contingency that could have happened at every point in time, and every contingency that could happen from that moment on. It's way beyond me to understand that, but I think that that could be the way that that goes. I know that he gives us free will, the ability to choose what we'll do, whether to follow him or not. Okay? I also know that he knows the end from the beginning. And so, to reconcile those things, I have to come up with this idea in my head that, yeah, he's given me free will. I can choose to do any of 75 different things at any one time. And he has a contingency plan for every one of those. He knows the contingency of every one of those. He doesn't have a plan for it. He has a contingency for every one of those, and he's followed each one of them out to their logical conclusion. I don't know necessarily that he knows which one of those we're going to choose. I believe that... This is one of the things that we're going to... I think that he's given us the free will, and at any moment we can choose to do any of those 75 different things. He's just continued on in each one of those lines. I could be wrong. He might actually know exactly what we're going to choose at every different time.
Yes, he does.
But I think that what he does is that he knows what that choice will bring and continues on in that line.
But in the midst of every one of the choices, as you pointed out, Yeshua gave a prayer to the disciples where he says, "Lead us not into temptation." And so we do have the option. At every point we have a choice. Mm-hmm. We can be led into temptation, but by being in reliance upon him, he will know how to keep us in the midst of what could be a very tempting situation or what would appear to be being led into temptation. So he then, therefore, will lead us out of it. So the security for the believer is to continue to pray in the midst of your life's journey. Lead us not into temptation. Lead me not into a place where I'm going to corrupt and turn away from you, like what happened with the adversary. There was a point in time where he looked down, if he was one of the anointed cherubs that covers, and he's looking upon the glory of Elohim, he goes, "You know, I'd like to have that for myself." You know, and that was maybe the seed that began to grow, that became the temptation that led to his final corruption. We have that possibility at every moment in our lives to be led into corruption, but we have to pray that his power to sanctify us will overwhelm those desires for self-corruption.
Okay, go ahead, Debbie.
I forgot which psalm it is. It said that if I make my bed in hell, you're with me there. There's no place that I can go that thou art not with me. And I believe because thou, the Lord, is with you always, yes, he knows which way you're going to go because he's with you. So in that sense, I agree with Tom. In another sense, I agree with you. Because we have free will, I don't believe the Lord knows which choice we're going to make because...
Well, he certainly doesn't mandate it.
Exactly. He hasn't preconceived it. I believe he knows which choice we're going to make because he's already seen it.
There you go. That's the way I think. It sounds like a paradox. Okay? It sounds like a paradox. The world is full of them. Okay? Yes, Yahweh knows the end from the beginning. He knows every choice that we can make. He knows which choice we will make. Yes, but we still have the choice.
Absolutely.
And it's just impossible for our finite minds to actually grasp it. But that doesn't make it not true. Yeah. That's true. Yahweh is not constricted by time, Valkran. Okay.
Isn't there another scripture that states when I don't remember exactly who it was, but they were praying, why? Oh, I believe it's the saints that were martyred. They said, how long?
Yeah.
How much longer before you avenge our blood?
Yes, right.
And
the saints under the altar.
I believe there was an explanation at that point that until those who are called come in.
Right.
So in that sense,
yeah,
it goes back to what you're saying. He does not know which choice we're going to make, but he gives us enough time to get to the final choice that we're going to make.
Huh? Could be. I don't know. This is actually getting way beyond my ability to follow. Okay. I'm not. Okay, he tells us to choose life, but he doesn't force us to choose life. Again, exactly right, Yachad 1. Yahweh is a perfect gentleman. Okay? He will not force us to do anything. He gives us guidelines, he gives us a direction, but he doesn't force us to follow his directions. And so we have the choice, always. He absolutely, and you, Teshuvah, you say, one yachad, you're right. He knows exactly, absolutely what we'll do. That's because he knows the only ways that we can go. And I think has the plan in place to follow it.
But for us, it's free will because he's so far and above us.
Right, exactly. To us, okay, great. Yahweh's so far above us, even though he knows what we're going to do, that doesn't mean that, first of all, that he forces us to do it. It's just that he knows. And he has always worked a contingency, a way to make those things work together for our good. If we're called according to his purposes, right?
Yeah, but he makes our hearts to be right by allowing us to go through what it takes to make us become what he wants us to be, to choose the right thing. Right? And he won't. However, he does again say, my spirit will not always strive with you, as a warning.
Okay. Did we finish? Yes, we did finish the psalm. Are there any other questions or comments on the psalm?
Well, I just like the way that it ends. It ends with a resting, committing oneself into the care of Yahweh. Cast your burden upon Yahweh and he will sustain you. He will never allow the righteous to be shaken. So, which I like about so many of the Psalms is that they conclude on a good note, that there is a hope, there is a future, that there is an assurance to the one who trusts in Yahweh for the deliverance.
Sehr gut. Tov me'od. Are there any other questions or comments about the Psalm, about the Torah or the Haftarah before we move on to the Brit Hadashah? The Brit Hadashah is going to tie us right back to the Torah for today. Okay, then we're moving on. Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 to 42, which go like this. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. By the way, it does say that in the scripture, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But just those words taken out of their context don't make any sense. Here we go. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But I say that you resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him also the other. And if any man will sue thee at the law, and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. That pretty much covers almost the entire Torah portion we had today. It goes far beyond the Torah portion. That's exactly right. But you know what? I don't think that Yahweh was, or Yeshua was telling us anything different than what the Torah actually tells us. Okay? He didn't add to the Torah. He didn't subtract from the Torah. He didn't supersede the Torah. He taught it the way it was supposed to be taught. So he says, yeah, you see that eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I'm telling you that instead of looking to get back at the guy that wronged you, you ought to heap burning coals on his head. Pray for him that despitefully uses you. You know, bless the person who comes against you. Am I correct? That is what he says, isn't it? Okay, so I don't believe that he's because many people will take this and they'll say, well, you see, he was telling us the Torah was no good. That's not what he was telling us at all. What he was telling us is the Torah is a great thing. It's the guide for your life. It is the way. It is the truth. It is the life. Okay? No man comes to the Father except through Yeshua, who is the living Torah. So what he's saying is, take that truth. Yeah, when he does you wrong, you are to have restitution made to you. But you know what? You don't have to take the restitution. He's talking about our motivation, not what the Torah says. That's what he's applying here, I think. What do you got, Ron?
Well, the Torah that was written at the time, Mount Sinai, giving to the word there, it was written to a group of people that were going to enter into a geographic location. They were going to control that particular landmass under a particular type of government that was established by Yahweh Elohim to be lived out as a tribal village family of a nation where they would be able to be a testimony and a light to the then known world for a period of time. But the fulfillment came with so many of the purposes of Yahweh as he was going through the different points in history, going from judges to kings to being put in bondage and slavery at different points of time to finally the Messiah coming and bringing about a change, because it was only going to be a short period of time that the nation of Israel would exist as a nation until 1947-48, because they were going to be destroyed in 70 AD and be completely removed as a people, as a nation, and no longer be able to be that type of a testimony. And so the Torah is true, and it had a direct application for that particular group of people at that time, just as the temple regulations would continue until 70 AD as well. But Yeshua, he came to fulfill the law, and he elevated the law, because what happened is then we took it to a cultural context that would expand out into the entire world. And he knew that his people would be put in places where they were going to be oppressed, and that they would not have to value the things of this world. The things of this world would diminish in value, the material things, the living as a nation, as a cultural group of people that would have a government that would be established by Elohim. The closest thing that's come to Israel as a nation would be the United States itself, established as a constitutional democratic republic, whereby the foundational principles of this nation were vested in the scriptures with the very founding documents given over to a reliance upon Yahweh Elohim, and recognizing that the only way that this nation could actually function for any length of time under those particular documents was with a Christian perspective. And so, getting back to the original premise of these particular verses that are being given now, they're applied in the light that you might be taken by the Romans and made into a human candle, or be put on a cross for nothing that you've done wrong. But you're still to be just like Messiah Yeshua, and to forgive them, and to be willing to give up the things of this material world to a greater degree than you would before when you were living within the context of a particular nation culture. And so we have to realize that these perspectives, this paradigm, is changing now to where we have to look upon the eternal value of our actions. Even though they had that back then, I'm trying to make myself clear in regards to living out the Christian experience for the eternal purposes of the individual who's living them out, and then also for the eternal purposes of Yahweh, who is using your existence to reach the world and to change the world around you, because you're willing to do things that are against the world, because it's an upside-down kingdom that he's developing, because it's a hidden kingdom. He said his kingdom was not of this world, but his kingdom is within us. And it's a veiled kingdom, and it's going to come with the millennium, but it is revealed to the world around through the individual who's willing to love in a way that seems contrary to the things of this world. Just like Corrie Ten Boom being willing to forgive her oppressors in the midst of a very difficult and trying time.
That's right. Yeah, I think it has everything to do with our personal attitude that Yeshua is talking about. He's not negating Torah. He's not adding to it. He's not taking away from it. He's telling you, look at yourself. That's what he's saying. Are there other questions or comments on chapter 5, verses 38 to 42? Go ahead, Tom.
We've had Eddie explain before how in the name of Yahweh we have mercy and judgment. I can't remember how that goes. But in our Torah portion, we were seeing, in essence, the judgment or the letter of the law, measure for measure. Here we're seeing the mercy side of Yahweh. It's interesting, as I look at these examples, I'm seeing an example of someone that's dead to self. Let me just pick one here. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let them have your coat also. We have the right to demand to, you know, we could sue that person back. But if you consider yourself dead, then you have that mercy to just go ahead and give them the coat also. Or whoever forces you to go 1 mile, you don't demand that he goes a mile, you go with him too. It's totally a mercy application we're seeing here.
I believe you're correct, and I believe that's what we're looking at here. Judge your own motives, okay, and work the mercy that Yahweh works for you to other people. Well, how hard is that? That's not hard. Actually, it's very hard for you to do it, but it's not hard to understand. Are there any other questions or comments on these five verses in Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 to 42?
Yeah, I still have this question that how does this verse actually, you know, we have heard that Yeshua actually was explaining the Torah. He was not certainly not negating or canceling, adding anything. But he was supposed to explain it, to fulfill it and give the full explanation of it. So whatever he said should do that, right? So when he says that, how do these verse actually explain the Torah?
I don't know that it explains the Torah.
Yeah, but in the sense
it explains us and how we're supposed to what our responsibility is in light of Torah. That's what I think.
So that was not already in the Torah. That's my question. Okay, you see what I mean?
I don't think that it is in Torah,
but it was hidden, because this is the sense that I see. You know, it was maybe in the Torah, but it was hidden, and it was not revealed until.
Perhaps what I think what we're seeing here is application of the Torah to our lives.
Yeah.
Okay. More so than Yeshua was trained as a Pharisee as well. If you don't believe that, you can look in John chapter 1, I believe, in verse 36, where John says to the Pharisees, "There stands one among you whose shoe latchet I am unworthy to unloose." But I'm not worthy to unloose.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So John the Baptist said that Yeshua was a Pharisee, was trained with the Pharisees. Okay? Now, being that that's true, it only follows that Yeshua would teach using a Midrashic form, just like Paul did.
Yeah.
Okay? So, what he's doing is he's taking the Torah and he's applying it. That's what Midrash is about.
I think so too.
Okay? So, that's what I think is happening.
Yeah, that's what I think too. That, just like you mentioned before, I think the previous Shabbat, that Paul was teaching in a Midrashic way, or
right.
Hebrew, or sorry, actually Hebrew.
Yes.
But I think you can generalize it.
Yeah.
Because the so-called New Testament is not supposed to be a new.
it's
supposed to be renewed of something already existing.
Exactly.
Or explain something that was already there. And I think that's what he's doing here. So that was the sense of my question. What was in the Torah that was actually hidden that he's revealing here?
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
But what was it?
Sorry?
Yeah, what was it? I mean,
I blew it.
What is where is the Messiah referring to? I mean, what portion? Where would you find that principle?
Where would you find that principle in the Torah that Messiah is teaching his disciples, teaching the people he's talking to how to apply to their life? There is no place in the Torah that projects that sediment or that.
I will agree with that.
Okay, so
I will agree with that. And what I'm saying here is that he's not negating the Torah by teaching this. What he's doing is he's saying, now here's how you apply that to you. Okay? You apply this Torah, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, blood for blood. You apply that by saying, I'm going to be just as much like Yahweh as I can possibly be. And I'm going to be merciful in this particular case. He's not saying that the whole idea of eye for eye, tooth for tooth is not valid as a restitution kind of thing, because that's what it's talking about, is restitution.
Right.
What he's saying, in other words, you can't beat somebody on the head just because you got beaten on the head.
He's actually teaching in a Midrashic way. Like
yes.
You said, he said, this is what is written in the Torah, but there are other things like the mercy side of Yahweh,
right,
which is not exactly in that passage that you have read, which is somewhere else that you should cross-reference or you should add to that.
Well, I can, yes.
Something
I can go with that.
Yeah.
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 Such as, vengeance is mine, I will repay.
Say it Yahweh. That's exactly right.
And guess who had to pay it? Yahshua.
Yeshua had to pay it. As a matter of fact, we saw that in the teaching today. That's right. He's the one that died the death of the adulterous bride.
Thus, he's the one who gave his cheek.
He's the one that put that.
It's in there too.
That became the curse
of
the adulterous woman.
Okay.
Okay. So, yeah. Also,
thinking of how Yeshua took it to a new level of mercy and grace. Well, mercy is not getting what we deserve, and grace is getting what we don't deserve. So, if you think about what he's saying here, it's. It's very applicable, and it makes very much clear sense to bringing the Torah to a new level of understanding and application.
I think he's saying, be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect.
There you go.
So this is the way I see it, is that we can read the Torah, but being narrow-minded.
Yes.
That is true?
Well, yeah. I think that where you're coming from here is, You can apply the Torah legalistically, exactly what it says and only exactly what it says.
Yeah.
But the Torah, like all Scripture, is multifaceted, with many levels,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
many depth levels, and he's going into a deeper level of
right.
this thing.
I think so. I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
I know the answer to your question. It's in Jehovah Jireh. He shall provide the lamb. Because Isaac was supposed to be sacrificed on the altar. Yeah. And then when Abraham went to sacrifice him, God provided the lamb, which was, of course, Yahshua. So we're supposed to die, the eye for the eye, the tooth for the tooth, to pay the restitution.
Mm-hmm.
But then he already showed in the Scriptures how there will be a substitution. Someone else is going to pay for that. thus lending your cheek to the smiters.
Right, that's what all the sacrifices were an yeah. illustration of the rest of the substitutionary atonement. No sacrifice ever paid for one sin. Sacrifices were illustration. And since the person who was doing the offering is the one that had to do the killing, okay, of the sin sacrifice, it was a personal thing. Now he sees what suffering the animal has to go through because he did what he did. Okay? Now he understands the suffering that Yeshua, what Yahweh has to go through because he did what he did. Okay? So this animal sacrifices never paid for anything. You can read that in Hebrews chapter 10. It talks about it all day and all night. Yeshua's sacrifice is the only thing that paid for anything. Okay? And everything else is an illustration. And it's to drive the point home to the sinner when he has to kill that animal. He has to draw that knife across his throat. Okay? That this is happening because I did something that Yahweh told me not to do. I'm the one that's drawing this blood. You know? It's my fault. And hopefully that will soften his heart and he won't do it again.
No, it'll never work though. Because it may make him feel more guilty, but it can't prevent him from committing some sort of sin again, because the Lord said that the sacrifice of the animals will never take away the conscience. Never change the conscience not to sin. It won't end the sin nature. Only his blood could do that. So that's why, you know, the eye for the eye, tooth for the tooth will never work.
Right.
So he's trying to say that kind of a sacrifice, that kind of vengeance isn't going to stop the problem. The only thing that will stop it is his sacrifice, which is turning his cheek. Mm-hmm. To pay for the sin. Is it any other way won't work?
I agree with you. No other way can work for the covering or the washing away of a sin.
Correct.
Absolutely correct. Yeshua is the only one that can do that. Okay. Are there other questions or comments on those first five verses? We do have five more verses in chapter 7. Chapter 7, verses 1 through 5. Judge not that ye be not judged. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. Do you see how this ties in with Matthew chapter 5 and verses 38 through 42? Okay. And why beholdest thou the mote that is in your brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Are you getting the Midrashic point that we're trying to make here today? For how wilt thou say to thy brother, let me pull out the mote out of thine eye, and behold, a beam is in thine own eye? Thou hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then thou shalt see clearly to cast out the mote out of thy brother's eye. Here's where the point is made. Again, for what we were looking at in 5:38 to 42, and what we're looking at through the Torah portion today. Let's look at our own motivations. Let's look at ourselves first and see how this applies to us before we apply it to somebody else. Okay? It's that simple. I know there's got to be a question or a comment, but let me give you some of the stuff I've got in my notes here. Watch out for your standard in judgment for verse 1. That is the standard you will be judged by. Use Torah to judge yourself and others. Let Yahweh's word be your standard. Because if you do that, then he's going to use his word as his standard as well. And his word towards us is mercy and grace and not judgment.
I think what I'm going to say is pretty much what you're saying. Know your own standing before Yahweh that you may judge rightly.
Yes, exactly right. Okay. Before you nudge judge another, judge yourself. That's what verse 3 is telling us. work out your own... Okay, thou hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to cast out the mote out of thy brother's eye. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. In other words, worry about your own work, walk with Yeshua. When you are as set apart as He is, then you can worry about helping other people with their walk. Okay. Okay? That's a tall order. It's a real tall order. Now, does that mean that if you see a brother in an obvious sin, that you're not supposed to go to your brother and say, "Hey, this is an obvious sin. I witnessed you do it, and I'm going to tell you, you need to repent before Yahweh. It didn't harm me. It harmed Yahweh. It harmed your relationship with Yahweh, and you need to take care of it." If he listens and he says, "Yes, you're absolutely right. It was," and he repents and he turns to Yahweh, then you have reconciled your brother to Yahweh. Okay? And that's one of the most important things that we have to do, is to reconcile our brethren to Yahweh. If he doesn't listen, then that's when you start using the Matthew 18 recipe. The principle. There you go. The Matthew 18 principle, which is, okay, now I've told him, he hasn't listened to me. Now I take two brethren with me to be witnesses, and I should take them with me cold. They shouldn't know anything about what I'm going to talk to this other guy about. Okay? So that they can judge righteously. Because if I give them what I believe is wrong, I have colored their judgment already. Okay? So, he refuses to hear you, and you've got two witnesses to prove it. Now you can take him before the court. That is the Beit Din in the Kahal, in the church. And you can bring it before them. And they can decide whether to cut that man off from fellowship. And that's what they did in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, when Paul said, "You got this guy that's sleeping with his mother. You got to get that guy out of your congregation." And they did it. And sure enough, by the time he wrote the second book, which was only a few weeks later, that guy was repentant and wanted to come back. And now he had to give the Corinthian church the instruction again, "Hey, the guy's repented. Accept him back." Okay? He's repented before Yahweh. He's his sin has been forgiven. Now bring him back. And see to it that it doesn't happen again. And make sure that it doesn't happen with you personally. Okay. Other questions or comments? Chapter 5 of Matthew. Chapter 7 of Matthew. Are there any questions up here in the... No, it doesn't look like. If there's nothing else in this room, and if there's no one in Pal Talk that wants to jump in, I'd say that we're about done. It was a blessing to be here with you. I hope it was a blessing for you to be in the room listening to us ramble. And we praise Yahweh for you guys being here. And we hope that it was a blessing for you. And we're going to tell you shalom in Yeshua the Messiah. Amen. What? I'll be back in a couple of minutes to talk to you. Hang on. What? Shabbat shalom, y'all. This is Mark. I'm filling in for Eddie again. And as you can tell, we're moving even slower than we would if he were here. What time is it? 4 o'clock. We're getting started at 4 o'clock. Sorry about that, folks, but about 2:30. Okay, for you folks out in Pal Talk land, we are not going to have any special Shavuot gathering tomorrow. We're all going to go and visit with, in my case, my family is going to be visiting with our family. We have family up from Georgia, and it's going to be the only chance that we have to visit with them. And we've just decided that we're gonna Shabbat on Shabbat. Okay, it is a high Sabbath tomorrow, and we're gonna wish you all Hag Sameach, Shavuot, in Yeshua the Messiah. Amen.